sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk about those greedy teachers. Yeah, those people who want health care and a decent living wage. And, oh, by the way, to protect the institutions that they work for, protect the future of education. You know, those greedy people. Also going to talk about the tinfoil Republicans who are coming out of the woodwork. And maybe Haley Babar is correct. Maybe a good proctological exam is just what the GOP needs. Also going to talk about, did you know there are black people in Maine? Well, they're going to find out if there are or not, if it takes sending out a postcard. Going to talk about that. Also, austerity baby or cut baby cut. I'm going to talk about that. And, of course, more of the Papa John's types rearing their ugly heads, finding more and better and more creative ways of screwing workers. We're going to talk about that. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. It's where you can email and calls 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. New report out by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in conjunction with the Economic Policy Institute. The report titled Pulling Apart, a State-by-State Analysis of Income Trends, shows something, something I think we all already know. I mean, there's really nothing new here. It's just putting what we've already known actually into writing. And that is that income inequality in this country has grown in virtually every state in the country, virtually every corner, every segment of the population. We have seen the splitting apart of this nation. We have seen workers being decoupled from their workplaces and the profits and the wealth that they create being extracted from them. We've seen it. And it's going to continue to get worse until we do something different. So that's sad. You look at the report, and the report says that in the United States as a whole, the poorest fifth of households in the country had an income somewhere around $20,000, $20,510, while the top fifth averaged about $164,490 is the number, eight times as much. In 15 states, they say this top-to-bottom ratio exceeded 8%. Now, understand, as they point out, in the late 1970s, no state in this country had a top-to-bottom ratio exceeding 8%. They just didn't. Yet, well, here we are. And the map that they show, it's pretty amazing. Because, not surprisingly, you look at the southern states that are overwhelmingly Republican. You look at the Arizonas, the New Mexicos, the Texas, the Oklahomas, Louisianas, the Mississippis, Georgias, Floridas, all of those, greater than eight times. Greater. The only state in pretty much the entire South that had less than 7% would have been Arkansas. And that's only because, well, and I can't even imagine why, because the Waltons live there and they basically skew the entire country. But then I started thinking about it. Well, they're probably the only ones. Everybody else, well, left. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, wow, So the bottom fifth and the top fifth are splitting and going in opposite directions. You know, what about that, you know, that top fifth? Well, of that top fifth, they have gained about $2,550 per year of additional income each and every year for the past 30 years. While the people in the bottom fifth, and this just blows my mind. So think about this for a second. The people who are in that top fifth, that top 20%, the people in that $165,000 and up range, they have seen $2,550 a year every year for the last 30 years increase. The bottom fifth, that bottom 20% of the population, over that same 30-year period, they've seen just $1,300 total. I mean, think about that for a second. $1,300 over a 30-year, that's it. You want to talk about, well, you want to talk about getting screwed? Well, this is part of it. But then you look at the richest 5%. That quarter of the top one-fifth, if you will. Their their take home, they're pocketed more than $100,000. So even within that top fifth, even within that top tier, it's going and the gulf is widening. And you go and you look at this and you go, are we surprised by it? And the answer is really no. You look at the CEO class where the big CEOs have seen their income skyrocket. I think the number was like 127 times what the average worker increase has been over the last 30 years, where now you've got these CEOs who are making 400 or 500 times what the average worker makes. And you see that the tax rates for these upper crust folks have plummeted at the lowest point that they've been at least in the last 60 years. And you look at reports that have come out that, you know what, as a nation, we're more unequal. There's greater income inequality in this nation than you see in the Ivory Coast or Pakistan or even ancient Rome. And you go, wait, that can't be. Huh? The numbers are what they are. And with all of this wealth that we've given, with all of this wealth that workers have created, that has been paid to the chair because, you know, those are the job creators. Those are people create stuff. Because if it weren't for them, we'd just be standing around looking at each other. We wouldn't know what to do because, you know, we need them. You look at this and you go, we've created the world's largest billionaire class. And at what expense? Well, at the expense of we no longer have the world's premier infrastructure. We're no longer the envy of the world. Our educational system is quickly diminishing. The prowess there is quickly diminishing. And we're no longer going to be that place where the rest of the world sends their best and brightest to be educated. And, oh, by the way, a lot of them stay. We're no longer going to have, and I don't know that we have in the last 30 years, had the K through 12 educational system that's been the envy of the world, because we've been steadily defunding that. And you keep looking at, you know, what we've done to create this large billionaire class, and you go, there's something wrong. And you look at what's being called this last 10 years, the lost decade, which has created this greater income inequality. Because we just had the big bust. You know, we had the little boom and everyone, hey, we're going to get a little piece of the pie, then bust! And they come in, they take it back. And you look here in Pennsylvania, for instance. As part of this report, between the late 1990s and the mid-2000s, annual incomes for the richest fifth of Pennsylvania households grew by 7.2%. The folks at the bottom, that bottom fifth, their wages fell by 7.9%. That's what I would call a massive redistribution of wealth. Because as one end falls, the other, hey, it's good more for us. And you look at the income gap between the very richest households and low-income households, well, it's increased even more dramatically. And then you go up that richest 5%, you know, the upper crust, the ones who have, you know, shot off from the top fifth, well, that 5%, well, they saw their wealth grow, their income grow by, well, over 11% in that just that decade. And in every category, we're seeing this nation splitting apart. And it's, you know, we're creating these extraordinarily wealthy folks at the top. And then that little bit that, oh, we're almost there. And then the rest of us. And there are a lot of things that we can do to fix some of this stuff. And I've said for years, we need a more progressive tax code where the Mitt Romneys of the world actually pay a higher tax than the rest of us. I'm sorry, your shoulders are bigger, you got more ability to, we should be requiring it. And I remember talking to a friend of mine who's, you know, he said that, you know, his father, they're from London. And he said that during World War II, his father was honored to be able to pay the top marginal tax rate, which at the time was 95%. Now, they were extraordinarily well-to-do in that, time, but he said his father was actually honored. He was helping the country. And he knew that. We need to go back to having a tax code that says, you know what? You're doing wildly well, and you're going to continue to do wildly well. But you're going to have to kick a little bit in. Because we need to invest in our infrastructure. We need to invest in manufacturing. We need to invest in education, in scientific research. We need to be investing so much in that. And we're not. There are so many things that we should be doing. First and foremost, for me, reform our tax code. I mean, that's to where we have the more you earn, the more you're going to pay. And I'm sorry, you know, I don't care how you get your income. I don't care if it's you're swinging a hammer or you're gambling or you're picking boogers out of your nose and selling them on the street corner. Income is income. Should be taxed the same. I don't care if you're gambling on Wall Street or gambling in the casino. Because explain to me, how is it when I go down to the casino and I don't, but say I did, and I put down the bet and I won a big payday. Why is it I'm going to pay, 30-40%? Any gamblers? Probably higher than that even. But I gamble on Wall Street, 15%. Explain that to me. Because gambling to me is gambling. Because we're not actually investing in these companies anymore. I'm a huge fan of investing in companies. Like they used to do here. You have a little piece of the company. No. You're gambling. So by reforming the tax code, and oh, by the way, a transaction tax on all stock transactions, I think is only reasonable. We should be looking at the minimum wage, increasing that to where it's actually a minimum wage that to exist. Not the minimum by which we can get by an employer can get by to get away with paying anything decent, but to actually have a living. And to be able to support yourself and index it with inflation. You know, I was looking at Australia, for instance. Their minimum wage is like $17 an hour. Ours is 7.25. And we should index it. So we don't have to keep having these fights and we don't have to go, what was the last time it was raised? Six years ago? Over the 6 years, it's been eaten away by inflation. It's time. We need to go back and undo all of the austerity. We need to put money into education. We need to put money into public schools and public universities so we don't have these fights all the time that, oh, wow, you know, these greedy teachers. No, we should respect teachers. But maybe that's too much to ask for. Because what we're being sold is, wow, those are just lazy people. Like the unemployed. And this weekend there's going to be a Saturday. There's going to be a day of action across the state. The We Want to Work Day of Action. We'll put some stuff up at thericksmithshow.com to see if in the area where there's some stuff at. But you know, this idea that the right keeps throwing out that, well, those unemployed, they don't want to work. Nonsense. The reality is there's four or five people out there for every job opening. And we've got a governor who's been pushing austerity. Slashing education funding. And when we come back, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about the latest contract negotiations going on with APSCEF and the State Universities of Higher Education here in the state. Because, you know, Corbett austerity, a huge part of it. Quick break, right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. It's been more than a month since Long Beach, California voters overwhelmingly approved a living wage ordinance, boosting the livelihoods of 2,000 of the city's hotel workers with $13 an hour, 5 sick days a year, and 100% protection for their tips. Leilani Albano reports.
You just stay like that. Just give like a half.
With
one.
A grueling campaign behind them, Long Beach hotel workers smiled and laughed as they posed for pictures for their campaign site. Measure N will serve as an economic boon by providing 2,000 hotel servers, housekeepers, and others a $5 an hour boost in pay from the $8 minimum wage they were receiving. Experts say the measure will add $7 million in yearly funding, as well as 85 jobs in the area. Reverend Nestor Jarente of Grace United Methodist Church was among those who campaigned for the bill.
64% of our voters in Long Beach expressed their commitment to make this city a place where people who work hard, particularly our hotel workers, are adequately compensated for their labor.
A coalition of progressive groups was integral to passage of the measure. They included labor unions, Filipino groups such as Anak Bayan Los Angeles, churches, LGBTQ groups, and politicians. Business leaders say the high cost of the initiative will drive hotels out of Long Beach. But Unite Here organizer Lorena Lopez Masumi says that the tourism industry has profited from the hundreds of millions of dollars in public funding it has received over the last decade to prop up hotels.
The city of Long Beach is a city that for many years have subsidized the hotel industry, and the community, the workers, have not received anything back from that investment.
According to workers' testimonies, hotels are employing a number of tactics to avoid implementing the new measure, which takes effect on December 21. For Workers Independent News, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Stand Up Chicago released a new report Tuesday detailing the impact that poverty-level wages have on educational outcomes for Chicago kids. Stand Up Chicago's Elizabeth Parisian says that the report shows if you're serious about improving student performance, you should raise their parents' wages.
Low-income students face a number of challenges in the classroom, health problems, to having to move frequently, hunger, you name it, and those obviously impact their outcomes. So what we're seeing in Chicago is we have this movement to hold teachers responsible for these out-of-school factors like a parent's income. And so what our report finds is that if you simply raise wages for minimum wage and low-wage workers, the most effective way to improve academic outcomes for CPS students.
The report found that to meet basic needs, a one-parent, one-child family needs $17.24 an hour in Chicago, double what many food and retail workers there earn.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our Commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So like I said last night, we were talking with the professor from Shippensburg. You know, I was watching the news the other morning, and on the news, there they are. I was like, well, you know, these union people, they're angry that they're going to have to pay for health care. They're angry that they're not getting wage increase. And really just spinning this situation with the professors at our state system of higher education as well, the basic right-wing frame. They're greedy and they're only self-centered and out for themselves. But when you really get into what's going on and what the negotiations are truly about, I got to be honest, the money didn't seem to be all that important as much as the profession, as much as education as a direction in this country. Which is why I think this is an issue that's important to talk about and to talk about with our friends and our neighbors and to make sure that we really know, instead of what's being thrown at us by the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media, actually understand what they're talking about, which is why I've asked Lisa Milhouse. She's an associate professor of communication at the Westchester University here in Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on the show.
You know, I look at this news report I saw the other morning, and if I didn't know and if this wasn't something that I was paying attention to, I would think, man, these are just greedy people, and they just want more of my money, and, well, we need to get rid of them.
Yeah, I know, and I really think it's important that we get the message out there that it isn't about the money. It's about whether or not we can have a say in how many students we're teaching or what kinds of classroom situations we're looking at. Or even we want to say in how our health care is set up.
It's that weird little thing about wanting to, have a voice.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think if more people, you know, and there's part of me that goes, you know, it's been such a concerted effort by big business and by the right to push this message on people. Well, you don't need contracts. You don't need collective bargaining. You don't need to have any say or voice or any democracy in the workplace. No, you don't need any of that. That's just a burden.
Well, but I got to tell you, we have watched just in the last 2 years because of Governor Corbett's attacks on state funding for the system. The faculty have really seen the amount of work they're doing grow just incredibly because we've taken on the extra burden of larger class sizes. We get asked to serve on various committees or task forces or to propose whole new curriculum. We need to scout and try out and see if they will work. And none of the individual things are very much in and of themselves, but when you start to look at the amount that we're, of extra work that we're being asked to shoulder, it's really, if we didn't have a CBA and the ability to negotiate, say, wait a minute, if you're going to make me do more work, then you really need to be paying me for what I'm doing.
That, and the other part of this is, look, if I'm a student and my professor's got all of this extra, got larger class sizes and he's got more responsibility and more duties and all, more hours of work, that means less time for me, no?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've got to think, I mean, at Westchester University, we have about 40% of the class time hours are being taught by adjunct faculty. And these folks are on the lowest end of the pay scale. They make about $45,000 a year. So that in their classes, if 7 students pay tuition, that covers the salary for that professor. Those professors are teaching classes of 50, 90, 150 students.
Wow.
So it's so unfair. If you have a full professor who is at the top of the scale, it does take 22 students to pay the faculty salary, but even those professors are teaching more than 22 students. So it's a huge disparity in terms of what the students think that college is, what they're paying for college, and where the money is being spent.
So then where is the money being spent? I mean, I look at this and you go, yeah, I thought it was much higher than the rates you just laid out. Where does the rest of this revenue go then?
Well, I mean, it's true. Faculty are the money-making engine of the institution, and so we do have to make the money to cover the salaries of the librarians and the financial aid officers and the counseling staff
and
the coaches. So, I mean, we do need to bring in more than just our salaries. Really, isn't what students are paying for, isn't that the education part of it? Shouldn't we be, instead of removing more and more and more from instruction, shouldn't we be plowing some of that money back into instruction so that students are getting a quality product?
Explain what an adjunct professor is, because we hear a lot of this. We hear a lot of these folks who, you know, I hear a lot of that stuff, and I know that distance learning is a big issue in this, and I want to talk about that, because we're seeing a lot of this, you know, online education. Who are the people teaching those courses? So I think it's important that folks get kind of the term. So when you talk about an adjunct professor, what are you talking about?
Well, I would distinguish between folks who are in a tenure track line, and so we have to jump through incredible hoops to get through tenure. But once we get tenure, we have some academic freedom. You can take risks in the classroom, and you're expected to do a certain amount of publishing. So there are fairly high standards. For the folks who get an adjunct position, there is no guarantee to those folks that they will be employed next semester. Their entire continuance of their job is sort of dependent on whether students like them or not. Many of these folks have PhDs. They thought they would get a tenure-track job somewhere, and there just wasn't a tenure-track job available. We have some really talented and excellent folks at Westchester teaching for us that I would love to put into a tenure-track line. We do also have adjuncts who finished a master's degree, and they're trying it out to see, you know, is this something I want to do? Do I want to go on for a PhD? And so those are really talented folks as well, but they haven't finished all of the same academic credentials as some of the other folks, but really excellent teachers and doing a great job. But in terms of the pay, if they're not teaching a full load, they do not get the same kinds of benefits.
Right.
And so they're really in a very difficult position, because when you're a faculty member, your job is to kind of push the envelope. You want to help students get further than they think they can go, that's not always comfortable. And if your job is to try and make everybody happy in the classroom, then you may not be pushing students as far as they can go.
Yeah, and
it's really difficult.
Yeah, and well, we really don't want critical thinking students. We want people who are just going to push the buttons and not ask why, and
well,
you know, do what they're told.
Right. Well, we're hoping that that's not where we're headed, but you know, you do hear a lot of that.
But I mean, when you laid out this adjunct versus a professor situation, the first thing I'm thinking is well, these adjuncts had better give decent grades and they better not fail people because they may not be back next semester.
Because
you know, you're going to get rid of the students because they failed out.
Right. I mean, and it's not that these folks are not given the same kind of resources to succeed in the classroom. These are excellent people. They could do very well. And yet, because they don't have job, you know, they can't
security.
Control whether or not they continue their job, they're really stuck.
Let's talk about a couple of the issues in this negotiations. One of the big ones is this distance learning, the online courses and all that, which I'm of the mindset, and you know, having taken a number of these distance learning courses, personally, I think they're an enormous waste of time. I don't think I got anything. I shouldn't say anything. I don't think I got much value out of taking them other than I read the book and wrote a paper. There was no real interaction with the professors. There were no lectures. I mean, it was just a little bit of reading. So I'm not a fan of distance learning whatsoever. But I know the universities see this as a cash cow, so they're going to be pushing it heavily. And I understand this is one of the key issues you guys are fighting through.
Well, Westchester University did have an online digital university fairly early on where we were beginning to experiment with how could we do online courses. And we found really early on that, you know, to do it well, you can't do these large, you know, it's not a cash cow. It's actually a time suck and a money suck in terms of the technology that's required and just the amount of time that it takes to field all the questions and to provide one-on-one interaction with students. So I do think there's a lot of distance ed that is not worth the money you pay for it.
Yeah, wow. You said there was some one-on-one interaction in your distance courses. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And so Westchester has been behind the curve in terms of putting out numbers of distance education courses. And I think because we were very cautious about the quality that we wanted to have. And we have a number of very talented faculty who see that there are things you can do with some of the online technology that you actually can't do in the classroom. So there are benefits to it. We're also doing a lot of what we call blended courses. So you maybe would meet face-to-face one day a week, but then you would have classes that would meet virtually, either all in the same time period but online, or people would check in at different times online. So I think it is possible to do a good job with education online, but it is too tempting to just fill the classes to the brim, take the money and run.
Yep.
And we want to really guard against that.
And when I saw this as one of the key issues, because I got to be honest, the direction of higher education in this country is hugely important to me, because I think as soon as higher education is taken over, we're going to see it filtering down to K-12, and we already are. We're seeing these cyber charter schools, which, you know, for the most part aren't worth even the advertising dollar that they put into it. But my fear is once we've moved to this is what's going to happen throughout education. And my experience, and maybe I'm jaded, was very negative. I don't think I got as much out of it as I should have. And that's when I saw you guys, this was one of the sticking points. I'm hoping that you're the place where we begin to save education in this country.
Yeah, I really think that the more we push on it, I mean, we want to make sure that we have the protections in place so that it is quality online distance ed.
Right.
It seems to me, although perhaps people are willing to pay for a piece of paper that says they have a diploma, but it seems to me if you're going to invest all this money in a course or a degree, don't you think you want to know who the expert is that you're learning from?
Absolutely.
You know, have some kind of interaction with that person?
And I want to have an expert. I don't want somebody teaching the course who just got the piece of paper that I'm getting. And that's what that's what worries me, that the people who are teaching the courses are going to have the same qualifications. And I see that really in the whole charter school movement and all of this, you know, this cyber charter stuff. I see it's a kind of this whole incestuous relationship of the same type of folks in this, and that's one of my big concerns. But I do think, distance ed, if you do it right, could be done properly, but as you point out, it's hugely expensive. I want to talk about real quick about, this contract, because, you guys have been fighting this, 16 months now?
Yes, 22 months.
How's it been now? Wow.
I mean, 16 months we've been out without a contract, but we started negotiating before it expired.
And I understand there was a strike authorization vote taken. That doesn't mean you're going on strike, but the authorization happened, correct?
The vote ended yesterday. The ballots have been sent UPS up to Harrisburg, and they'll be counted on Friday. So we'll know what the outcome is. But it looks like we got a really good turnout. I mean, across the state, I think we got 85-90% at almost all the schools. So
where does this go? I mean, this gives your negotiators the power to say, look, we're serious. We've got to sit down and we've got to hammer something out, or something's going to happen.
Yeah. No, what's really sad is that we stayed at the table so long thinking that if we just talk long enough, we'll figure out a way. We're all educated people. We should be able to find a way to make this work. And we've had two opportunities where we had a breakthrough in negotiations. Both times the union had to kind of use outside leverage to force something to happen, like have a strike authorization vote. So it's frustrating because really the way to do a negotiation is not with threats and that, but really to sit down and we understand, you've got to pay for the system, but it shouldn't be on the backs of the faculty.
Wow. You're smart people too. You actually think you can negotiate. Look at that. Wow.
We thought we could.
I mean, because, when I look at this and I look at what's going on the last 2 years, and this is just me looking at it from purely a political standpoint, you've got a governor who's really trying to make his bones off the back of education so he can give more tax cuts to big corporations and more handouts. I understand why he's doing it. I just don't like the way he's doing it.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically off the backs of you and my children's future. So I understand mm-hmm. that. And he has put people into those positions where, those are their marching orders, which is why I'm glad to see that finally someone's going to stand up and tell the bully no more.
Yeah, and we're hoping that we do get support from other public sector unions as well, because really what we're fighting in terms of the retirement health care situation is, we've been set up to be the first union to fall, and if we do give in on this issue, we see it just dominoes across the state.
Well, as I've been saying for the longest time, we're all in the shark tank, Lisa, and it's just even right now you're the flavor of the month. But eventually they're going to come for me next.
I'll have to use that one. That's good.
You can have to use my other one as well. If you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably on the menu. That's always a good one. But what can we do to help? I mean, as this is Friday, tomorrow we'll know what the numbers are. What can folks do to help? What are you guys asking?
I think we need to let the chancellor know. We need to talk about why education is important, and that, just increasing class size to huge numbers is not important, that if people are going to pay higher tuition, then we need to see where that money is going and that it's going back into a classroom or at least campus or educational experiences. I think the more we can make noise about it, it seems to help.
I'm right there with you, but I think the governor has an answer. Natural gas wells on all of your campuses.
Oh, well, Westchester doesn't have the gas below, I think we also we've created a Facebook page called WCU Adjunct, and that's, we're trying to do more to feature the folks that are on the bottom doing a ton of work for very little recognition, and so that's another thing that people can do is let us know when you've had a connection with one of our adjunct faculty, make that information known so that we can say, look, it's important that we resource these folks so that they can do the good job that they know they can do.
Yeah, I think this is all very important. And we'll get a link at thericksmithshow.com to your Facebook page. Just click on Lisa Melhouse's name. It'll take you right over there. Lisa, it's been great talking with you. I wish you guys nothing but the best of luck, and I hope you'll come back when you guys win this and tell me about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Lisa Milhouse, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Westchester University. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has...
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. It's not easy to get in the face of power and defy the conventional wisdom. You can quickly get to feeling like B.B. King when he sings, "Nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving too." Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein know that lonely feeling. This pair of think tank political pundits has long been popular on Washington's insider talk show circuit as cautious middle-of-the-road voices of conventional thinking. But then, they went rogue. Recently, Mann and Ornstein charged that the elite media deliberately failed to cover the biggest 2012 election story of all, namely that the Republican Party and its nominees were flagrantly running a campaign of lies. The duo was surprisingly blunt, noting that the GOP was not just practicing politics as usual with a fib here and a prevarication there, but an orchestrated strategy of dumping bald-faced fabrications wholesale on the voting public. "It's the great, unreported, big story of American politics," said Ornstein. While the Democrats, too, tossed out some falsehoods, there was no comparison between them and the Republicans' ideologically extreme perversion of, quote, facts, evidence, and science. Yet reporters and their bosses, fearful of being accused of taking sides, failed to make a distinction, which, after all, is their job. "They're so timid," Mann said, "and a timid press is a weak one." "You're failing in your fundamental responsibility," Ornstein said of them, asking the obvious question, "What are you there for? Your job is to report the truth." This is Jim Hightower saying, as their reward for daring to tell the truth about the media's abject failure, Mann and Ornstein have been blackballed. They're no longer invited to talk on the insider shows, nor have those shows even mentioned the media's pusillanimous role in abetting the big lies of 2012.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
And, you know, the more of this, you know, I look at this situation with the professors, these folks over at APSCUF, who, you know, like she said, 22 months they've been trying to negotiate. Oh, silly people. You can sit down and negotiate with people who are hell-bent. They've got it in their head from the beginning. "We're going to rob from you. We're going to destroy your profession. We're going to privatize the whole thing." That's the goal. And you understand, I mean, the Pennsylvania system of higher education, the 14 state-owned universities, it's like the 10th largest university system in the country. This is an asset that we in this state have that has been handed down generation after generation, built by the past, that they want to privatize. That's the goal. Privatize. Sell it off. Profitize it. Because, hey, there's big money to be made. I mean, you look at last Friday, a week ago. The governor said, "Oh, we're gonna privatize the lottery," and I'm thinking, well, you know, why don't we just privatize it like it used to be? Give it back to the mob. Maybe that's what we should do. Just give it back. Give it back. We'll take our little vig. We'll take a cut out of it. I mean, this whole privatization thing has gone nuts. And I look at this. I just read a report that there's a lawsuit being brought against the Idaho correctional centers. Out in Idaho, they've privatized two Corrections Corporations of America, one of the big for-profit prison industry leader there. The lawsuit alleges, and it makes perfect sense to me, kind of what our military has done over in Iraq and Afghanistan, kind of that's the corporate model. What this lawsuit alleges is that the company, this Corrections Corporation of America, has personnel costs by partnering with the prison gangs. Yes, going to go to the Crips and the Bloods and go, you know what? We need to hold down the violence. So you guys, we're going to help you out. We need you to help control the prison. The inmates are literally controlling the prisons. I guess I wouldn't find it as funny if what happened up in Schuylkill County, up north, where you had the prison sentences for pay, where you had the kids who were doing, you know, something dumb like kids do, getting long sentences because the private for-profit prison industry was paying off the judges, this whole criminal incestuous relationship, and it doesn't surprise me. This whole profitization, hey, we need to cut costs at all costs, no matter what it means. No matter if it means we're going to be locking kids up for nothing for months and months and years and ruining their future so we can make a quick buck now, or we're selling our soul to the gangbangers so that maybe they'll be okay. And hey, you know, once they control that, what's next? And then we're talking about privatizing the wine and spirit shops and the lottery. And you know what? Why don't we just give it back to the mob? At least they spread the wealth a little bit. But it just blows my mind. Just absolutely. And I guess it shouldn't. It shouldn't surprise me one bit, because that's capitalism. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Get up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need.
call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth. Scientists who worked with fossils found in Tanzania have discovered what might be the oldest known dinosaur by at least 10 million years.
In other words, this dinosaur lineage appears 10 million to 15 million years earlier in the fossil record than any other known dinosaur. It's from the Middle Triassic period, which spanned a time between about 247 million and about 235 million years ago.
The researchers didn't have much to work with, just one humerus or upper arm bone and six vertebrae. They determined that the animal likely stood upright and measured 7 to 10 feet in length, about 2 to 3 meters, including its long tail.
When this dinosaur lived, the world's continents were joined together in a landmass called Pangaea. What's now Tanzania would have been part of southern Pangaea, sometimes called Gondwana or Gondwanaland, a supercontinent that also included Africa, South America, Antarctica, and Australia. These researchers said the new findings placed the early evolution of dinosaurs and dinosaur-like reptiles in the southern part of Earth's globe.
They said this specimen has a lot of history. The bones were discovered in the 1930s and first described in the 1950s. Now, 80 years later, modern scientists have put the pieces together enough to publish their work. They did this in the journal Biology Letters in December of 2012.
Today's program was made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Doja. Of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
No! It's an angry looking black man on TV opening a door. He's opening the door. Oh, bad footage there. Kind of hard to push the whole voter suppression thing when the guy's opening the door for voters to go in. But he was standing guard, and look at him, he's looking kind of angry. I love fake news on Fox. If you saw today, they showed the Hispanic voters going to the polls, and the footage that they were reeling, the B-roll, people crossing the border, walking through the things. That's the Hispanic vote in 2012, or so they're trying to say. You wonder why the Hispanic vote went 71% for the president. Just kind of wonder. Republicans scratching their heads. Paul Ryan said, well, it wasn't none of the issues we lost. It was because of those urbans. And you got Romney going, was because Obama was giving out gifts. Not like he wasn't going to, but my favorite is Maine Republican Party State Chairman Charlie Webster, who was being interviewed on one of the NBC affiliates, did you know there are black people in Maine? Evidently he didn't either.
You still think we have a system that's full of fraud?
I do, yeah. I'm going to do a mailing right off. In some parts of the state, there were, for example, in some parts of rural Maine, there were dozens of black people who came in and voted election day. Everybody has a right to vote. But nobody in town knows anybody's black. How did that happen? I don't know. We're going to find out. I think it's a problem. I think it's a problem.
Where did that happen?
In several rural Maine towns. And what I'm doing is I'm purchasing a postcard. We're going to mail it in and thank people for registering to vote and see where that comes back.
Yeah, we're going to send cards. That's why I've asked Pat Lamar. She is one of the hosts of the Pulse Morning Talk Show on WZON up in Maine. Regionally, she was the vice president of Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter in Carlisle before she took the Pulse gig. Pat, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome.
So, what do you think of Charlie, your guy? They're black people in Maine.
No one in those towns have ever seen them.
It's because they're hiding.
You know, Maine is a constant source of embarrassment now because we have Governor LePage, who said, insulted the NAACP when they invited him to breakfast, and then insisted that he had a black child, and it turned out it was his caddy. So, I mean, Charlie Webster is just a little mild, quite frankly.
LePage, the guy who took great joy in saying that he beat people up for their Halloween candy.
Yeah, and that the President of the United States, he would like to tell him to kiss his butt or whatever. Yeah, it's bad. It's pretty bad. The Republican Party has a rank and file of noble people who believe that Abraham Lincoln was a good guy. And then their leadership is this collection of chuckleheads. And, you know, I don't know what to tell you.
So what kind of pushback is Charlie getting? Or are the people of Maine going, see, there were dozens and there are dozens, and we didn't know there were dozens here?
Yeah, well, you know, the really sad thing is there were two women who tried to vote in Auburn, Maine, which is one of the more diverse parts. That's our very urban sort of center. It was Milltown to Auburn and Lewiston. It was a place where, you know, the French immigrants were constantly, like, being just chattel in the mills. And, you know, up here to have a French last name like mine, you get all the jokes about you. And, you know, this was the minority. And then there were these huge Sudanese and Somali refugee fluxes, and they came to Maine. And so a couple of women of color went to vote, and they actually were challenged, hassled, defended by the ACLU of Maine, and proven to be citizens of the United States, you know, legitimate voters, and yet hassled at the polls. So what Charlie's saying is fantasy and makes me want to put my teeth under my pillow. But this is what's really happening is the few people of color we do have with the courage to go out and be Americans are getting hassled.
Yeah. You know, I went and I looked at the census numbers because, you know, I was going, wow, I thought Maine by law had to be all white. And it turns out in every one of your counties, every single county, you have black people. And you know who else you have? You've got those Asians. You know, the Asians that evidently threw the election for Obama because the right's going nuts. You know, the Asians, they voted, while the Hispanics were 71% in Obama's corner, the Asian Americans, they were 72%.
Well, you know what we have here? We have Native Americans. We have Indian reservations.
I saw that.
we have people that we are so proud of, and the only people anyone talks about outside the borders are people like Charlie Webster.
But, you know, he's the one who is saying the dumb stuff.
Yeah, no, not the only one. Thanks, though, for that vote of confidence. But, you know, it's just that, you know, he's the outgoing guy. He's very much up against the wall because, believe it or not, he was the guy who led the fight against Paul LePage when Paul LePage wanted to seat the Republican convention with the Ron Paul delegates. And so, you know, it's literally a slugfest in the Republican Party right now. And again, I'll say that the rank and file up here are really people who are like, oh, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. Oh, hey, did you hear of Lincoln? I mean, the normal everyday Republican is, you know, a decent guy.
So you have some of those still, because I'm finding those folks are fewer and farther between. What I'm finding are more of the LePages and more of the insaniacs on the far right.
Well, you know what's happened, I think, and it's really hard to diagnose, is that it's any savior in a storm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they've got these people who rise to the top like so many bubbles in really bad champagne. And so they're so grateful to have some leadership that got elected that then when the leadership turns out to be absolutely wacky, you know, they're like, well, okay, but maybe we'll get a little bit of our agenda advanced and we'll give them a chance.
He might be wacky. He might be wacky, but he's our wacky guy.
Yeah, and it's awful. And I think this whole politics of fear and the us versus them and all that stuff—it's really—it's really coming to bear on people, and it's tiring them out. And quite frankly, the media is not helping. Not my show and your show, but that mainstream pile of crap that you were just discussing—they're not helping because they wanted us to believe this race was so close that you know, it was going to be a whisker away from who knew what. They wanted us to believe that stuff so that they could totally slant the story and create news instead of report news.
Well, I mean, we do live in an era of infotainment. I mean, the people who are supposed to be giving us the news, they need to sensationalize. You know, they need the shiny thing to get advertisers because, hey, we do live in a advertiser-based media culture.
I know. And you know, I think it's time for every regular everyday old red-blooded United States citizen to say, you know what? I think I'm really just going to care about my neighbor. You know that wonderful feeling I have on Christmas morning? I think I'll try and have it 365 days a year. I'll pretend I'm LLB. I'll be open all the time.
There you go.
You know,
the problem is what if you don't like your neighbor?
Well, learn to like them. Liking the people that are easy to like isn't the point. like somebody you don't like. It's how you learn to, like, coexist.
But, you know, this whole thing for me highlights, because, look, we've got our own insaniac here. We've got Mike Turzai, Speaker of the House.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
You know, we've got our own insaniac, so it's, you know, it is what it is. But at the end of this, you know, the more I look at this, the more we need to be pushing for an agenda nationwide of making voting much easier. And I'm not sure how it is in Maine, but, you know, here we decide 13 hours on a Tuesday what direction our state and which direction the country is going to go. And if we can challenge somebody, then it's further down the road. We should be expanding the right to the franchise.
Yeah, you guys have a 30-day waiting period to vote, the registration to vote. What if someone moves into the state during that 30-day period? Our felons can vote. Our people in jail can vote. Charlie Webster got his armpit in a ringer because he tried to make same-day voter registration illegal, and the people went nuts. They did. Republicans and Democrats alike went nuts, and independents, which we have more of than either of the two parties. So, yeah, I mean, we only have one border with the United States, and that's New Hampshire, and so they're pretty fiercely independent up here.
Right.
But that doesn't change the fact that if we're not careful, I mean, they tried to do the voter ID laws. They tried to do all that stuff. We have some of the highest voter turnout in the country, and that is because of same-day voter registration. I mean, the fact that somebody actually can't say, oh, my God, it's election day, I want to go down and vote. They can't do that with their finger. You know what they do in the countries that we invade? They stick a finger in purple ink. Hey, is your finger purple? You already voted. If your finger's not purple, go ahead and vote. You know? I mean.
That's what I've been saying. I mean, we've spent trillions of dollars to give people the right to vote, but here we're trying to figure out every way we can suppress it. And when some black people come out, there were dozens and dozens.
Yeah, and
very strange.
What about the fact that we're the melting pot, we're the inclusive place, we're the wonderful, you know, you're poor, you're tired, you're huddled mess. Emma Lazarus is trying to, like, move to Canada.
Yeah, we're not that country anymore. or not. I mean, there's some hope, I think. I think there are signs of hope. I look at the younger generation, and I'm hopeful. I did want to, before I have to take a break here in a minute and a half, I did want to ask about your new senator-elect. What kind of guy is Angus King going to be?
Well, I was quite impressed that he said he was going to caucus with the Democrats. He's a thoughtful man. He's probably one of the smartest people I've ever debated, you know, and interviewed. But, you know, Bush said he was going to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. He said he was, the jury was out on the, National Defense Authorization Act. So I think people should be cautious.
Yeah. Again, you know, once you start throwing it, we're going to make sure we keep the well-heeled. I have a problem with that.
Yeah, me too.
Especially when we're talking about cutting granny and like we did here in the state of Pennsylvania, kicking poor working people off of minimal health insurance and kicking kids off CHIP and eliminating the general assistance budget for the most vulnerable in the state so we can give tax handouts to big corporations. I got a problem with that.
I got a problem with it too. And the guy's a millionaire, so he's just giving a tax cut to himself. So we've got to really keep an eye on people like that and hold their feet to the fire. They've got to hear from the voter.
Yep, absolutely. Pat LaMarsha, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. The Pulse morning talk show over on WZON up in Maine. Way we can get that online?
Absolutely. Just zoneradio.com/thepulse.
And we will make sure we get a link at therickSmithShow.com. Pat, great talking with you again. I'd love to have you back again soon.
Lovely. Thanks for having me.
Quick break. Right back with the second hour of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm The Talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. It's been more than a month since Long Beach, California voters overwhelmingly approved a living wage ordinance, boosting the livelihoods of 2,000 of the city's hotel workers with $13 an hour, 5 sick days a year, and 100% protection for their tips. Leilani Albano reports.
You just stay like that.
Just give like a half.
With
one.
A grueling campaign behind them, Long Beach hotel workers smiled and laughed as they posed for pictures for their campaign site. Measure N will serve as an economic boon by providing 2,000 hotel servers, housekeepers, and others a $5 an hour boost in pay from the $8 minimum wage they were receiving. Experts say the measure will add $7 million in yearly funding, as well as 85 jobs in the area. Reverend Nestor Jarente of Grace United Methodist Church was among those who campaigned for the bill.
64% of our voters in Long Beach expressed their commitment to make this city a place where people who work hard, particularly our hotel workers, are adequately compensated for their labor.
A coalition of progressive groups was integral to passage of the measure. They included labor unions, Filipino groups such as Anak Bayan Los Angeles, churches, LGBTQ groups, and politicians. Business leaders say the high cost of the initiative will drive hotels out of Long Beach. But Unite Here organizer Lorena Lopez-Masumi says that the tourism industry has profited from the hundreds of millions of dollars in public funding it has received over the last decade to prop up hotels.
The city of Long Beach is a city that for many years have subsidized the hotel industry, and the community, the workers, have not received anything back from that investment.
According to workers' testimonies, hotels are employing a number of tactics to avoid implementing the new measure, which takes effect on December 21. For Workers Independent News, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Stand Up Chicago released a new report Tuesday detailing the impact that poverty-level wages have on educational outcomes for Chicago kids. Stand Up Chicago's Elizabeth Parisian says that the report shows if you're serious about improving student performance, you should raise their parents' wages.
Low-income students face a number of challenges in the classroom, health problems, having to move frequently, hunger, you name it, and those obviously impact their outcomes. So what we're seeing in Chicago is we have this movement to hold teachers responsible for these out-of-school factors like a parent's income. And so what our report finds is that if you simply raise wages for minimum wage and low-wage workers, the most effective way to improve academic outcomes for CPS students.
The report found that to meet basic needs, a one-parent, one-child family needs $17.24 an hour in Chicago, double what many food and retail workers there earn. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. And yes, it's coming. The Republicans are about to drop the A-bomb. Yes, the austerity bomb is coming. The fiscal showdown. Yes. Or as I think I'm going to start calling it, it's no longer the fiscal cliff. It's the fiscal mirage. Because this is a manufactured crisis. This is made up. This is one of those things that as easily as they created it, they could uncreate it. Which is why I've asked Michael Linden, Director for Tax and Budget Policy at American Progress, to come talk to us about the fiscal mirage. Michael, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the big A-bomb that they keep scaring us with, it's ticking.
Yes.
The austerity bomb, it's ticking. Is it the end of the world?
No, it's not. It's definitely not the end of the world. But it is also not something we should, you know, be hoping for. It would be bad if we didn't do anything about it and we, you know, went over the so-called cliff. It wouldn't be, you know, January 2nd, all of a sudden the world crashes around us. It would be kind of a gradual thing, but it wouldn't be great. And we should try to avoid it. But it's like, it's what you just said. It just as easily as they created it, they could very quickly uncreate it. It would not be that hard, to do that.
And this is where I think adults in the room have to come around to the realities that, you know what, we do have some problems, and there are some very real problems, right?
Yes, there are. I mean, look, there it is true that, you know, we have a budget problem. It's not the one that a lot of people have been, screaming about for the past couple of years. It's not our current deficit. It's the future deficits. And that is largely a product of the Bush tax cuts, frankly. There's other factors as well, no question about it. There's the aging of the population and rising health care costs. These are, you know, underlying economic trends. But the Bush tax cuts are a big, big part of it. And so we do need to do something about that. We can't just keep kicking the can down the road. On the other hand, you know, it doesn't make sense right now to raise taxes on middle class and working people. But this is a good opportunity for us to get rid of the Bush tax cuts for those who really don't need them, who really never needed them, and then we can talk more about what else we need to do about the future.
Yeah, I mean, because I look at this and look, I'll be honest, I'm someone who said maybe we should just let them all expire at some point because we do need to bring in more revenue. There's so many things that we should be investing in: roads, education, health care, all of those things at some point. But we need to get out of this 8% unemployment range.
Right.
Once we're back to full employment, once the economy is moving again, then I'm okay with, you know, completely doing away with the Bush tax cuts and actually bringing some revenue in to pay those debts down, to pay the future debt down, but not right now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, we did okay under the Clinton tax code.
If I remember right, I did extraordinarily well. And if it weren't for the tax reform, or if it weren't for the welfare shenanigans they pulled in '96, because I don't know if you knew, but where I lived, McDonald's before the welfare thing, McDonald's was paying $10 an hour back in the '90s. And then the welfare bill comes through, and they pushed all these low-wage workers into the workforce and just dropped the bottom out of it. But, you know, but the tax code, I thought, was fine.
Yeah, the tax code was fine. It was bringing in enough revenue. The economy was doing okay, better than okay, really. So this argument that, you know, if we went back to the Clinton tax code, there would be some kind of economic Armageddon really doesn't make a lot of sense. But look, you know, people like me, progressives, and you know, mainstream economists have been saying for the past 3 years, now is not the time to be cutting our deficit. That's still true today. Now, it makes a big difference between raising taxes on people who really can't afford it right now and raising taxes on people who really can. You raise taxes on people who really can't afford it, it's not going to have any negative impact on the economy. In fact, the fact that we're going to have lower debt in the future is likely to help the economy a little bit. To take that money, reinvest it, like you said, in roads and bridges and education, some job creation now, you could end up with a net positive. And the simple fact is, we do need more revenue. You said it yourself, you know, you just said it. We need more revenue. This is the moment to do it. The Bush tax cuts are expiring. The president just won re-election. He was very clear. Nobody can accuse him of hiding the agenda, right? He ran ads, and he said in those ads, under my plan, the wealthy will pay more. He wasn't hiding it, and people understood that, and they voted for him. This is the moment now to let those tax cuts for the rich expire.
And I think the American people are there. I mean, you look
they
at
are. They are definitely there.
The exit polls, you know, proved it. 60% of the people, both Democrats and Republicans, said, you know what, we need to raise that upper – we need to raise taxes. In fact, I just saw a poll by the small business owner group, Small Business Majority, that showed 57% of small business owners say we need to increase taxes on the wealthy, and that it wouldn't do any harm to our economy, and it would do more harm if we actually went through the spending cuts to their business than with raising taxes on the very wealthy.
That's absolutely true. And look, it's been true for years. It's been true from the beginning, but I think that, frankly, the conservatives in Congress were crossing their fingers and hoping that they would be able to defeat the president, and so they stuck to this extremely hard-line position. I'm hopeful that they're starting to wake up. You know, they really have been living in a bit of an alternative reality, you know, where the polls weren't telling the truth, where the jobs numbers were cooked, where, you know, all this stuff was just fake. But now they can't ignore the fact that the president did get reelected by a comfortable majority.
Yep.
And as you said, and as he said in his press conference yesterday, more people agree with him about this tax issue than voted for him. This is not a controversial issue anywhere except in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you know, David Stockman said, you know, he wrote in a piece not too long ago that, you know, the Republicans and Paul Ryan have this tax-cutting fetish. And I like that frame because that's kind of what it is. They have this, you know, this obsession and this blind faith belief that if we lower rates and we continue to cut taxes, that somehow the job fairy is going to create things. And it's just not in reality. I mean, they talk about the tax reform bill of 86 and say, well, it brought more money in. And I said, well, no, it didn't. Not over the long haul.
No. And what they never talk about in the tax reform of 86 is that we raised in taxes on corporations and we raised taxes on investment income to help pay for the tax cuts on the marginal rate. So they never mentioned that part. Ronald Reagan signed into law a 28% rate for capital gains. You know what it is today? 15%.
Yeah.
Right? So look, if Paul Ryan and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell would agree to raising the capital gains rate back to 28%, that could go a long way to getting us some revenue. But something tells me they're not going to agree to that.
Yeah, see, I got to be honest with you, though, Michael. I look at this, and I don't care how you make your money. I don't care if you're gambling it on the street corner or on Wall Street or if you're swinging a hammer. Income is income, and it should be taxed the same.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the principle, and that was the principle in 86, that everything got taxed the same. Now look, there are some, you know, arguments that I find at least a little bit persuasive that you want to have somewhat of a differential between ordinary income and investment income because you want to reward the risk taking. And whether you believe that or not, that's all well and good, but there's no question that the differential we have today of 20 points is totally unnecessary. So there is definitely room there, you would think, for reasonable people, for the adults in the room, as you put it, to compromise. But unfortunately, up until now, we have not seen a lot of adults on the other side of the aisle. I'm hopeful that that's changing. You do get a sense that there are people in the conservative movement who are coming around to this notion that, okay, they didn't win on this issue. They can't win on this issue. They look unreasonable to the American people. It's time to compromise.
Yeah, and for me, I got to be honest. Now is not the time to be cutting spending. And we don't need to look to Portugal or Spain or Greece to see the effects of job killing austerity. I mean, you could.
No, that's absolutely right. That is absolutely right. It's incredible to me that anybody is still talking about how we need spending cuts right now. You know, you look at these countries across the pond, and it has not gone well for them. In fact, there's some evidence that suggests that they aren't even able to reduce their debt because their economies have gotten so bad that it's actually they're losing revenue and they haven't actually been able to reduce their budget deficits. It's a you know vicious cycle. So we definitely do not want to mimic that approach here in the United States. That is a very much tried and failed strategy. That's exactly why we want to avoid the fiscal cliff. And like I said, the good news is we really can avoid it. You know, there's really no reason that the Republicans should block a very sensible solution. Keep the tax cuts in place for 98% of Americans. Let the other ones expire. It will affect less than 2% of Americans. It will not hurt the economy. Get rid of these spending cuts. Nobody really wants them to happen. And if you really want to talk about long-term deficit reduction, that's a conversation we can have, but let's have it not in the context of austerity. Let's have it in the context of investing now and bringing down the deficit in the future.
Yeah, you know, what I remembered, I go back to 2000, and every once in a while I allow myself to go back and wonder what if. But I remember Alan Greenspan back in 2000, you know, musing about what the future was going to look like because we were going to be, as a nation, debt-free. And I think about what happened since that point where, you know, we don't know what the future looks like because we're going to be a debt-free nation because we were paying the debt off so fast. And then to bring us to this point where, you know, we've got a pretty sizable debt now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, listen, if your listeners are interested in how we got to all this debt, on AmericanProgress.org, we actually just have a video up we put up just a couple weeks ago that explains exactly how we went from that exact point where we thought we were going to have no debt to all the debt that we do have, and we go step by step and explain exactly what happened to get us to this point where we have all this debt now. And it's a striking story, and it basically comes down to two words, President Bush.
Well, and you know, the same, and, well, I mean, neoliberalism with our bad trade policies and you know, supply-side voodoo Reaganomics as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this idea that tax cuts create growth and they can pay for themselves, and that all that prosperity will trickle down. That theory really was dealt a pretty devastating blow by the Bush administration.
Yep.
And I have to say I was surprised, given that, to see Governor Romney running on a sort of doubling down on that strategy. And I was pleased to see the American people reject it.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, the thing is, and you pointed it out here a second ago, they could easily agree, and I think everybody agrees, the 98% of the folks in this country should keep the tax code right where it is. It's amazing to me how much power that 2% has over an entire political party in this country. And, again, I take that back to, in large part, to Citizens United and our campaign finance laws.
I think there's definitely something to that. I try to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think that a lot of people in the conservative
You're a good guy like that.
What?
You're a good guy like that.
I try, you know. I think a lot of people in the conservative movement, they genuinely believe that the way to improve the economy is by giving tax cuts to the rich. I mean, there may be some who are really craven and sort of cynical about it, but I think there are a lot of people who genuinely believe it.
But does it work?
It doesn't work. No, right. And just as I thought, just as there were genuinely people out there who believed that the polls were all wrong, right? They genuinely believed it. They weren't lying about it. They honestly believed the polls were wrong. They were wrong, is what it turned out.
Yeah.
That was incorrect. That was an incorrect belief, but they're genuine about it.
Okay.
And to some degree, I don't know that anything we can do, any experience we have, is going to convince that sort of core of the supply-siders. But what's important is that we convince and we explain to the broad middle that doesn't work. And the good news is they're very receptive to that because they lived through the Clinton administration. They lived through the Bush administration. They know that higher taxes on the rich doesn't mean economic disaster and lower taxes on the rich doesn't mean economic nirvana.
Yeah, I guess I can see how you would think that they truly believe it. Because, you know, every football play I ever drew up in my entire life went for 100 yards and for a touchdown.
Right,
and
exactly.
I truly believe that would happen. Even if there is a 20-yard loss and the quarterback was sacked every time, I truly believe that maybe once it would work, even
right.
though it rarely
exactly.
does.
Exactly. You say, well, that one time, here's all the reasons why that one time was a fluke. And you try it 10 more times, it still doesn't work. You come up with 10 more reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, at some point the fans start saying, try a different play.
Or dump the coach.
Right, exactly.
Michael, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
Our good friend Michael Linden, Director for Tax and Budget Policy at American Progress. Our website, AmericanProgress.org. We've got a link to get to the video that Michael was talking about. Just click on his name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
It's not easy to get in the face of power and defy the conventional wisdom. You can quickly get to feeling like B.B. King when he sings, "Nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving too." Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein know that lonely feeling. This pair of think tank political pundits has long been popular on Washington's insider talk show circuit as cautious middle-of-the-road voices of conventional thinking. But then, they went rogue. Recently, Mann and Ornstein charged that the elite media deliberately failed to cover the biggest 2012 election story of all, namely that the Republican Party and its nominees were flagrantly running a campaign of lies. The duo was surprisingly blunt, noting that the GOP was not just practicing politics as usual with a fib here and a prevarication there, but an orchestrated strategy of dumping bald-faced fabrications wholesale on the voting public. It's the great unreported big story of American politics, said Ornstein. While the Democrats, too, tossed out some falsehoods, there was no comparison between them and the Republicans' ideologically extreme perversion of, quote, facts, evidence, and science. Yet reporters and their bosses, fearful of being accused of taking sides, failed to make a distinction, which, after all, is their job. They're so timid, Mann said, and a timid press is a weak one. You're failing in your fundamental responsibility, Ornstein said of them, asking the obvious question, what are you there for? Your job is to report the truth. This is Jim Hightower saying, as their reward for daring to tell the truth about the media's abject failure, Mann and Ornstein have been blackballed. They're no longer invited to talk on the insider shows, nor have those shows even mentioned the media's pusillanimous role in abetting the big lies of 2012.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Back and I think about that. And you know, like I was saying with Michael Linden, and again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at thericksmithshow.com or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, I go back to that Greenspan thing because for me, that moment, you know, you start looking to the future. We're going to be a debt-free nation. Interest rates are going to be low. The future for my children. And look, all of that played into to my having children. I mean, you know, my wife and I, we're at that point where we're thinking about, okay, we're going to start a family. You know, I'm in my pushing middle 30s, you know, started to think, well, you know, now it's now or never. You start thinking about your financial situation, start thinking about the future of the country. So we decide things are looking good. That's a good, we're going to do that. Yes. 9/11 happens and then we find out we're pregnant. Oops. And then the Bush tax handouts. And then you start looking at the direction the country is going. And now, as a parent, you're going, what have I done? But I go back to that moment in 2000 when, man, if we don't follow bad conservative ideology, if we don't follow bad government people, this is a completely different nation. A completely different trajectory, just not for the country, but for the entire globe. If we don't do the Graham-Leach-Bliley, we don't do what the economic remodification, whatever the hell it was, act that said, oh, yeah, okay, gamble time. We don't do that. This is a different nation. And now what have we got? Well, we've got the tinfoil hat club. And, you know, the tinfoil hat used to be just for, you know, just the fringe, the real radical. Tinfoil has taken over the Republican Party. And being pushed really by fake news on Fox. Like I said earlier, they were talking about the Hispanic voters, and they show the Mexican border. You wonder why you're getting your hat handed to you. But you know, and maybe Bobby Jindal's right. Now, maybe, they need to stop dumbing down conservatism. Maybe they need to stop being the party of stupid. You know, maybe Haley Barbour today was right. Maybe they do need to give the party a serious proctological exam. Maybe. Maybe they need to examine themselves and figure out why they had a 20-point gap between male and female voters. Maybe they didn't think about that. The biggest gap in history. Maybe they need to think about it. Maybe they need to think about the party leadership. The folks who have... I mean, this thing with Romney just blows my mind. Coaching my daughter's basketball team. And, you know, to coach fifth and sixth grade girls basketball, you have to take a series of these courses. And one of them is teaching sportsmanship. And, you know, I just happened to look through the video and the material and all this past weekend. And, you know, I'm thinking about it. I'm going, you know, we've got a guy who was a presidential candidate who is showing the worst sportsmanship possible. I lost because of those black people and those students and those urbans and those others, because Obama was going to give them gifts. And I go, you know, did he not take eighth grade civics course? I still remember the first day of civics course. The teacher said, came up and said, understand, government decides who gets what. That's it. It's pretty simple. And this election was about that. This election was, do we continue down the path of giving more to the well-heeled, to the gated community class, to the private island, private jet class, the private country club class? Do we continue to give them more in the hopes that at some point something falls off the table for the rest of us to fight over? Something falls out of their deep pockets. Their insatiable appetite suddenly becomes, well, full. Or do we say, you know what? The wealth of this nation should be invested in the nation, should be invested in the people, should be invested in the future. And I think, you know, the election a week ago Tuesday said enough of the politics already. We need to get things done. It's enough already. We had the collapse. It's time to get this country back to full employment. But then that means we're going to need to raise taxes on the very wealthy. We're going to need to hold them accountable because we've given them an awful lot of control. But all we keep seeing is division. All I keep seeing is more of the same. And I look at this thing with Petraeus and the other tinfoil hat theory, conspiracy theory. Oh, Obama knew. Obama knew Benghazi was going to happen and he needed a patsy. And you know that's right, right? Of course. I mean, Obama was clairvoyant. Or the other conspiracy, Obama did it. Him and Bill Clinton, they snuck in and they did it. And I look at this fake news on Fox thing. You know, the job numbers that came out today. There's a conspiracy going on. Because, you know, he didn't want to give out the real numbers before the election, so he slipped them in after. Not that the huge hurricane that, you know, basically washed New York away. Not that those people lost their jobs. No. And the more I look at this, the more it's really about discrediting anything government does. That's their theme. That's their frame. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as you can discredit it. And I look at John McCain. And what's frustrating to me is, you know, I actually had some respect for John McCain at one point. That is gone now. Out there playing politics as usual. This whole Benghazi thing, as unfortunate as this situation is, should not be a political issue. We should find out, get to the bottom of it. We should hold those accountable for doing it. But at the end of the day, what he is doing, I think, is counterproductive. And while he's out giving press conferences, and while he's out doing television appearances, and while he's out doing radio and all doing all of the things that he's doing, he seems to have missed the briefing they had this morning on Benghazi. So he's out there calling for, an investigation, doing his dog and pony show. And some would argue, and the senator from Maine, Susan Collins, being one of them, who's wondering, you know, why it is he missed it. Is it interfering with his ability to gather information for the very event that he was asking for? And I think so. And what I find funny is they asked him about it, and he gave a very, well, very angry response. Now, his spokesperson said McCain was absent from the Benghazi hearing because of a scheduling error. Yeah. They scheduled a interview on TV and a press conference and all these other things instead of getting him doing his job. So maybe do your freaking job instead of this nonsensical political posture. look, the next election isn't for 2 years. You got about 6 months to get something done. And I'm told there's a big cliff coming. Or the mirage, whichever you believe. There's an idea, don't you think? Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky. Scientists who worked with fossils found in Tanzania have discovered what might be the oldest known dinosaur by at least 10 million years.
In other words, this dinosaur lineage appears 10 million to 15 million years earlier in the fossil record than any other known dinosaur. It's from the Middle Triassic period, which spanned a time between about 247 million and about 235 million years ago.
The researchers didn't have much to work with, just one humerus or upper arm bone and 6 vertebrae. They determined that the animal likely stood upright and measured 7 to 10 feet in length, about 2 to 3 meters, including its long tail.
When this dinosaur lived, the world's continents were joined together in a landmass called Pangaea. What's now Tanzania would have been part of southern Pangaea, sometimes called Gondwana or Gondwanaland, a supercontinent that also included Africa, South America, Antarctica, and Australia. These researchers said the new findings place the early evolution of dinosaurs and dinosaur-like reptiles in the southern part of Earth's globe.
They said this specimen has a lot of history. The bones were discovered in the 1930s and first described in the 1950s. Now, 80 years later, modern scientists have put the pieces together enough to publish their work. They did this in the journal Biology Letters in December of 2012.
Today's program was made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
We don't get it.
Shut it down.
If we don't get it.
Shut it down.
If we don't get it.
Shut it down.
If we don't get it.
Shut it down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So that was audio back from summer, last 2011, the Hershey, the packing plant over there in Hershey, where they had the J-1 visa students who come over here for cultural exchange. You want to see how things are like in the U.S. You know, kind of, you know, just a little, you know, educational tour. They end up putting them in a factory, in a packing house, working 40 hours a week, lifting heavy boxes, cramming them 4 or 5 into a room, charging them enough, so much that they ended up with paychecks of like 30, 40 bucks a week. Charged them 15 bucks just for the card that they swipe in and out the punch card to punch in and out of work. Mind-blowing. And at the time, I remember going, well, you know, maybe this was truly a cultural exchange. You know, maybe now we're going to start highlighting the fact that a lot of American workers get screwed like this as well. I see there's some movement now because of that, gained national attention, the program's being looked at, and good for those kids. And the hope was at the time that they were made whole. Well, I see a report that came out today, which is why I've asked Stephen Boykowitz, communication director at the National Guest Workers Alliance, guestworkeralliance.org, their website. Stephen, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, thanks so much for having us back. You showed such great attention and support to this fight back summer of 2011, and it's really great to be back with you.
So recap a little bit of what happened, if you would, for our listeners so that it refreshes their memory.
Sure. So this was a case where last summer, suddenly folks in Hershey's, Pennsylvania, were seeing hundreds of foreign students who had come for a cultural exchange program, paid $3,000 to $6,000 apiece for promises of chance to learn English, to meet Americans, experience American culture, and also to work. They understood there would be a work component. What they had no idea of was that they were going to find themselves working under really brutal conditions in the Hershey's packing plant right there in Palmyra, Pennsylvania, bruising up and down their arms and legs, people routinely working to exhaustion, paying twice market rates for housing that they had no choice, they were forced to live in. And any time they raised any concerns with supervisors, they were met with threats of firing and deportation. And this is after they had paid $3,000 to $6,000 just for the ability to come to the U.S. in the first place. So they were trapped by debt on one hand, threats on the other hand, and they were having a certain kind of cultural exchange, certain kind of cultural education, but certainly not the one that they anticipated.
And if I remember right at the time, it really, if highlighted for some folks locally, this employment web, if you will, of, you know, third-party logistics corporations, the building being owned by Hershey, but they have the subcontractor hiring the people and the subcontractor running the place. And it was really just this bizarre web, if I remember right.
Well, this was the really incredible thing about it. What the students, when they basically reached a breaking point, they reached out to our organization, the National Guest Worker Alliance. We came up and started to talk to them, learn about what they had experienced, and dug into just how it happened that Hershey's chocolates for the entire Eastern Seaboard were being packed by student guest workers who were making as little as a dollar an hour after deductions, as you mentioned. What we found out was that not too long ago, these jobs, these 400 jobs in this packing plant, had actually been performed by workers, local workers with rights, respect, and a union contract, making $18 to $24 an hour, living wage, folks were getting by. And Hershey's had laid off all of these workers and instituted a chain of subcontractors to replace what had been good living wage, stable union jobs with these outsourced, downsized, actually insourced, pretty brutal and drastically underpaid jobs for students who had expected a cultural exchange.
Right.
One of the really incredible things, though, was that once the students understood that, first of all, they decided to go on strike. You know, they brought their demands again to their supervisors. They were met with the same threats, and they said, "All right, we've had enough of this." And with incredible support from folks in labor, from working folks of all kinds, from unemployed folks in Pennsylvania, people really rallied around these students, helped them go out on strike. And because the students understood what had happened, they understood that basically because of Hershey's corporate greed, a whole chain of subcontracting and downsizing had led to what had been good local jobs becoming terrible local jobs for student, jobs for student guest workers. The students stood up, not just saying, "We would like to be made whole, the money we paid for cultural exchange, we want back." They stood up and said, "These jobs should be jobs for local workers."
Yep.
And not under terrible conditions, not under the kind of conditions we've been working in ourselves, but the jobs that they were not too long ago. These should be living wage, stable, reliable, jobs that local folks have a real chance to apply for and can make a living at.
And I remember, you know, back during that time, we were involved in that quite a bit. And I remember talking to a lot of these kids and just being in awe of the fact that they got that part of it. That it wasn't just about them, it wasn't just about this moment, but it was about those jobs being for the community and for the future. And that, I was really blown away by that because, you know, they've got no allegiance to here. They're from somewhere, they've got no allegiance to the people of this area, but they wanted to leave something better behind. That's what I was blown away by.
I tell you, it was one of the most beautiful things I had ever seen, and they were saying things, I mean, once they understood the chain that had been caught up in, the solidarity that was crossing lines. We're talking about students often from pretty difficult backgrounds themselves in countries that are far, far less, struggling far more than even the U.S. has been struggling recently. We're talking about Moldova, Turkey, rural China in some cases. You know, parents had paid enormous amounts of money to send these kids over. They could have just focused on what was difficulties for themselves and their families, but they really reached out, made the connections, and the way that folks in Pennsylvania rallied around them then when they were on the streets, you know, people honking, stopping, supporting, coming out to hear stories, joining protests, and inviting them into their homes once those students went out on strike. Was an incredibly beautiful moment of solidarity.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. Now, I understand yesterday there was an agreement between XL Logistics, which is the company that ran the warehouse that Hershey owned, and the Department of Labor. Tell me what happened there.
Yeah, actually, two pretty exciting things happened. The first was that agreement that you mentioned. So in this chain of subcontractors, the company at the top, actually running that chocolate packing plant, XL. Now, this is a big global corporation. They have more than 300 warehouses in the U.S. alone. They've got $4 billion in annual revenue. This is a pretty serious company. They agreed with the Department of Labor, under a certain amount of pressure, of course, to institute new worker protections for every single worker in every single one of those 300 plus warehouses as a result of the what came out in this case. What that means is that we don't have an exact number, but we're talking about tens of thousands of workers. There were 500 workers in that plant in the Hershey's packing plant alone. So you think about, even if you've got half that number in 300 plus warehouses around the country. These are tens of thousands of workers, U.S. workers and immigrant workers, right? Guest workers and local workers, folks of every description,
right,
who now have a new set of protections, thanks to this fight that the student guest workers, started with the help of local folks, and that so many powerful, allies in organized labor and other communities stood up to make happen. The second really exciting victory, together with that agreement between XL and the DOL, is that the Department of Labor is forcing XL, together with the other members of the subcontracting chain, SHS and Satusa, Hershey's labor recruiter, to pay $213,000 in back wages to the students for illegal deductions for their housing. And there's an additional $143,000 in fines. And the great thing about this is that in these subcontracting chains, these companies always try to pass the buck up and down the chain.
Right.
Everybody points the finger at somebody else. DOL said, no, you can't get away with it. You're all responsible, and you're all going to pay.
Good for them. You know, but when you say illegal deductions, what you really mean is wage theft. They stole from these kids.
That's exactly what it was. Not only were they deceived in the beginning about what they were coming to the United States for, but there were actually illegal, there was the wage theft going on. And this time, it's, you know, these fights, this happens in many different settings in almost every conceivable industry, into every kind of worker. But one of the most powerful things that happened here in this case is that just as the students stepped out and said, this fight is not just about us, just as folks in organized labor, all different kinds of communities around Pennsylvania stood up alongside them and said, we're fighting with you because this fight is a fight we have in common, this victory is one that benefits everybody. The students get at least some of what was taken from them back illegally. And they also have created a victory that will give tens of thousands of workers around the U.S. better conditions, more opportunities to organize, more dignity and respect at work every day in hundreds of warehouses around the country in a whole range of industries.
And not to mention, you know, locally, a very solid example of the power of solidarity and the power that, a committed number of people can change their conditions and change the direction of not only the community, but their lives as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what we heard when folks were inviting the students into their homes and sharing their own stories of struggle, folks who sometimes had been employed by the Hershey's Corporation a few years before, sometimes for generations, and their families had an understanding. There was a sort of social contract between the company and the family, and the idea was that if you worked hard, if you played by the rules, you would be able to have a good, solid, stable life. You, in some ways, gave your life to the company. They would acknowledge some responsibility on their own side. We've seen, not just by Hershey's, of course, but by all sorts of big corporations, we've seen that contract shattered again and again. That's what makes it even more inspiring and even more powerful when there's radical solidarity like we saw between students from all over the world, often from third world countries, in pretty outrageous situations, able to stand up, able in some ways to take the best traditions of American organizing, to get the support and solidarity of allies all around the state and all around the country, and then to create a victory like this.
And what I'm hoping is that what we're seeing across the country with the Walmart workers or the Walmart associates and the warehouse workers that feed into the Walmart stores, the same kind of thing, the same kind of solidarity to make their lives and their communities that much better. Let me ask you about the cultural exchange program, though, this whole J-1 visa thing, because there are, as we learned back in the summer of September of 2011, that there are, the abuses are widespread. Is there anything to look at this J-1 visa program? Have they done some investigations? Have they solved some of these abuses?
You know, this is another really exciting outcome of this fight. The State Department actually runs that summer work travel program, and some folks have described, I mean, the phrase "sleep at the wheel" has been repeated in some circles about just how bad the kinds of abuses that were happening within this program had gotten. Situations like the one in the Hershey's factory and far worse in some cases. And we're talking about tens of thousands of students every year. Fortunately, the pressure, the national attention, and the amazing organizing that the Hershey student strike led to last year set off a very hard look at the reality of this program by the Department of State. We at the National Guest Worker Alliance worked very closely with them, helping them understand just how bad things had gotten. And from the point of view of people who were in the inside, what was required to try to end these abuses. And they spent months working on essentially a complete overhaul of that program. And in May of 2012, they announced essentially a whole set of new rules to try to prevent what happened in the Hershey's plant from going on all around the country as it had been for some time. So we're now at the end of that summer season. Most of these is obviously summer work travel. Most of these students are here doing summer jobs. Certainly not perfect. There's still a ways to go. We did hear some reports of problems among various employers, but at very least, Department of State has a much clearer idea what's going on. And they understand that these sorts of problems can't be swept under the rug.
Yeah, this is an amazing story of absolute courage and bravery, and really a very, in my view, a good outcome, and just amazing to be part of as well.
Well, Rick, again, the level of attention and support and understanding and solidarity that you showed, that so many good folks around Pennsylvania showed at every step of the way from being out, getting arrested in amazing acts of civil disobedience right from the very beginning, the day the students went out on strike, to the attention and focus that you and lots of other folks helped bring day to day to the people who came out to support the protest street side in Hershey, Pennsylvania, to all the folks that have gotten since. You know, all of that is what made this victory possible. And it's been good for the students. It's going to be good for tens of thousands of workers around the state and around the U.S. And, you know, for my money, that's what these fights are all about.
Absolutely. Stephen Boykowicz, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the recap. And, you know, hey, this is a great victory.
Thank you so much, Rick, and thanks again for all your support.
Anytime. Stephen Boykowicz, Communications Director at the National Guest Worker Alliance, guestworkeralliance.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Stephen's name. It'll take you right there for an update of the story. Quick break, right back after this.
Your proud defender of a working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Homeowners, cold weather is almost upon us. Use the equity in your house to keep warm and toasty all winter long. Save your energy with new windows and keep the outside out and the inside in. Or roll out a new carpet for those holiday guests. Stop sending money out the door and get it on the house with a home equity line of credit from PSECU. You can borrow up to 80% of your home's value at just a 3.25 annual percentage rate with a PSECU home equity line of credit. Other rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/HELOC.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holidays.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, not if you listen to the Republicans, man. The others are coming. The others are coming. It's the urbans. The urbans are coming. You know, Paul Ryan said, well, you know, we lost because of the urbans. Mitt Romney, Obama won re-election because of the gifts to the urbans. You know, those black people and those Latinos and those women promised them contraception. And you look at the right and how radical they have become, and it's no wonder that they lost a 20% margin between women and men. And wake up, GOP, the women outnumber men. So if you have that big of a gap, you're in trouble. And understand, women are going to be running this country. I don't know if you've noticed the college enrollment, but they're outnumbering men mightily. You know, I drive by Dickinson College every day, and I can't tell you the last time I saw more than one or two guys walking down the street. I see groups of women walking around. The future leaders of this country, but not very many men. So party better, as Haley Barbour said, might need a proctological exam. But if you remember, you had Gingrich running around calling Obama the food stamp president. And you go and you look at this. The folks over at the Center for American Progress did this study. They looked at the census numbers. And they looked at what government assistance has done in 2011. And what they're saying is it kept 25 million people out of poverty. Be it the tax credits, the earned income tax credits, be it the supplemental nutrition assistance program, the food stamps, as the right loves to say, supplemental social security income, housing subsidy, all of those things, the heating assistance, the LIHEAP, the WIC program, all those things that the GOP very angrily against. 25 million people it kept out of poverty. Now, if you listen to the Republicans, they did run around saying, 1 in 6 people are living in poverty, yet the programs that they continually talk about, well, that creates more poverty. All of this austerity, more poverty. And what's going on in this country, the radicals now are the people who used to be in the middle class who are now looking down the barrel of poverty are turning towards these radicals who are giving them this, well, it's those others, it's the urbans. And these working people who have worked every day of their lives, they're the ones who are going, man, I'm ticked off, of which I was one. I could have easily been one of the Tea Party people saying, you know what, I am ticked off. You work hard, you play by the rules, you should be able to succeed in this country. So I look at Alabama.com. One of the news sites, like Penn Live or one of the other, but down in Alabama. And they're talking about this secession movement. There's like 150,000 people who have signed this secession petition because, we're going to have the whole country secede. Because according to this guy, Derek Belcher, that's the only way we're going to save the country. He said, I don't want to be Russia. I don't believe in socialism. America's supposed to be free. And, I loved his rationale. It's about economics, he says. He says, I've never taken a dime from the government. I'll starve before I'll take a handout. That's what it means to be a true American. And I would love to see his tax returns because I hear this a lot. I don't take anything. You don't. Explain that to me because when you start looking at people's tax, you've taken off a lot. And we take an awful lot for granted, and maybe that's because things have been just getting done for too long. And where the Republicans, and where there's part of me that goes, they're taking us down that road. At some point in the very near future with their austerity, it's not going to get done. And maybe then we wake up. I'm not quite sure, but maybe only then. But this whole secession movement, I've got an idea. Just leave. It's easy. You just get on the road and go. Maybe someone else will take you. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you can go to download the podcast. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break here, back with the third hour. Like I said, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. We're right back after this. I'm working all the time. It seems to me.
see red. The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. It's been more than a month since Long Beach, California voters overwhelmingly approved a living wage ordinance, boosting the livelihoods of 2,000 of the city's hotel workers with $13 an hour, 5 sick days a year, and 100% protection for their tips. Leilani Albano reports.
You just stay like that. Just give like a half.
With
one.
A grueling campaign behind them, Long Beach hotel workers smiled and laughed as they posed for pictures for their campaign site. Measure N will serve as an economic boon by providing 2,000 hotel servers, housekeepers, and others a $5 an hour boost in pay from the $8 minimum wage they were receiving. Experts say the measure will add $7 million in yearly funding, as well as 85 jobs in the area. Reverend Nestor Jarente of Grace United Methodist Church was among those who campaigned for the bill.
64% of our voters in Long Beach expressed their commitment to make this city a place where people who work hard, particularly our hotel workers, are adequately compensated for their labor.
A coalition of progressive groups was integral to passage of the measure. They included labor unions, Filipino groups such as Anak Bayan Los Angeles, churches, LGBTQ groups, and politicians. Business leaders say the high cost of the initiative will drive hotels out of Long Beach. But Unite Here organizer Lorena Lopez Masumi says that the tourism industry has profited from the hundreds of millions of dollars in public funding it has received over the last decade to prop up hotels.
The city of Long Beach is a city that for many years have subsidized the hotel industry, and the community, the workers, have not received anything back from that investment.
According to workers' testimonies, hotels are employing a number of tactics to avoid implementing the new measure, which takes effect on December 21. For Workers Independent News, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Stand Up Chicago released a new report Tuesday detailing the impact that poverty-level wages have on educational outcomes for Chicago kids. Stand Up Chicago's Elizabeth Parisian says that the report shows if you're serious about improving student performance, you should raise their parents' wages.
Low-income students face a number of challenges in the classroom, health problems, to having to move frequently, hunger, you name it, and those obviously impact their outcomes. So what we're seeing in Chicago is we have this movement to hold teachers responsible for these out-of-school factors like a parent's income. And so what our report finds is that if you simply raise wages for minimum wage and low-wage workers, the most effective way to improve academic outcomes for CPS students.
The report found that to meet basic needs, a one-parent, one-child family needs $17.24 an hour in Chicago, double what many food and retail workers there earn. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I got a list of demands. Written on the palm of my hand. Come on, my sister, you are no right man. We live in and of time. Still want to be somebody. Be somebody. Try to be somebody. Got a list of demands.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So Walmart associates and warehouse workers who move Walmart goods walked off the job yesterday and today to protest the company's attempts to silence workers who speak out for better conditions, better hours, better wages. Last night we spoke with one of the warehouse workers from Southern California who took part in the picket yesterday, took to the picket lines yesterday morning. This afternoon, Walmart associates from across the country took to the picket lines as well. And what is the first wave of what will be thousands of protests leading up to Black Friday? I've got Sarah Gilbert on the line. She's the department manager of Home Lines at a Walmart in the Seattle area, one of the folks who has taken to the streets to action today. Sarah, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So why is it that you have taken to these actions?
Well, I've worked with Walmart for about 3 years now, and I've seen a lot of horrible things going on. And I just decided that enough is enough, and I want to make things better.
And you know, I hear that time and time again, just to make things better, to better conditions, better treatment. Because the stories that I hear a lot about harassment, a lot of retaliation, a lot of intimidation. Is that kind of the story that you've got?
Well, my personal story does have to do with some harassment from my manager. In fact, I was putting away freight one day, and I have a female manager, and she came up behind me and pulled up my pants at work on the job. And I did what Walmart wants us to do and have an open door, which is basically a conversation with the management where you're supposed to be able to feel safe and talk about any concerns you have. I did that. He said he would take care of it, and nothing ever happened from that. And I continued to get harassed and bullied. And that's when I really decided to join our Walmart and try to make things better. But also, my gripe with Walmart is that I'm a working mother. I have five children. My husband's currently laid off with, with the working situations going on, especially right. In Washington State. We got hit really hard. And I'm not making enough money as a manager for the largest company of the world to take care of my family without some sort of public aid. And I just don't think that's right.
No, I'm with you. It sounds absolute. But, you know, going back to the incident with the manager there, I got to be honest, I don't think I would have taken it that way. I think I would have probably punched her in the mouth if it were me.
Well, to be honest,
but that's just
really
me.
That's really the way I felt too, but it's my job and I can't afford to not have one. So yeah. I have to try to follow Walmart's proper procedures and policies in order to make things better. But it's really like a smack in the face when nothing happens after you do what they want you to do.
Yeah. You know, and I look at this, and, you know, what we talk about here on the program, and I've talked to a number of Walmart workers, the associates, the people who work in the warehouses that feed their system, and it's the same story. They're built on a low-wage model. And I go back to my grandmother who, you know, during the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, did the exact job that you're doing, worked in a small department store in Cleveland, but they were a unionized department store, paid decent wages. In 1985, she was making $8 an hour with 6 weeks vacation, full health benefits, eye, dental, all of that stuff. And the conditions here we are 27 years later are worse than they were then.
Well, that's pretty amazing that she made that much money back then, because most associates at Walmart start around $9. So, I mean, it's not very good, obviously, that in 20 years it hasn't gotten to much of a higher raise.
And the reality is for the volume that Walmart sells and the amount of product that they sell, I mean, we're talking pennies per product that they could just raise pennies, a penny on a pair of socks, and offer their employees a living wage with full benefits and some retirement security. It isn't that heavy of a lift, I don't think.
No, I agree. And I've heard statistics that say if Walmart raises their prices one penny on every item in the store, which customers wouldn't even notice, that they'd be able to afford to pay us about $10,000 more a year and give us health care.
And the thing is that me as a taxpayer, and everybody listening to this program as a taxpayer, I would no longer have to subsidize the things like health care, like food stamps, like heating assistance, all of those social programs that I begrudge no one of who needs them. But we're talking about a company that is a global leader, a family, you know, that the six Walton family members have more wealth than 30% of the country. I think they can afford a little bit, just a little bit. I'm not asking for too much, but just a little bit.
Yeah, I actually heard it's about 45% of the United States, and that's completely ridiculous. I'm all for people being well off, but, I mean, it comes a point when it comes complete greed.
So let's talk about some of the stories that I've heard, you know, the folks like you who are willing to stand up, and I give you credit. I mean, the situation that you've laid out that you're in, I give you the ultimate credit for your bravery and your willingness to stand up and fight. But, you know, some of the stories I've heard of, you know, people like you who are willing to stand up, have seen hours being cut, have seen, retaliation on the job, things like that. Have you encountered any of that?
Not personally. I've never had that problem except for when I stood up and spoke about that getting harassed more. However, I see it happen every day, and I don't think there's one person who works for Walmart that says they can't, or that they haven't, I mean.
Right.
It happens every day. I've seen people who've asked for more hours and get their hours cut. Walmart tends to hire everybody part-time, and what they'll do is they'll work them for 10 weeks or so at full-time, because they have a policy if you work 12 weeks full-time, they have to make you full-time. So what they do is they have people work, 10 weeks at full-time, and then that 11th and 12th week, they'll cut them down to part-time so that they don't have to give them benefits.
That's amazing. And it's what's amazing is that in this country, we still allow that kind of behavior to go on. We allow these companies to do this stuff. But then again, I mean, most states are at will, and very few workers have rights unless they're doing something to try and organize like you guys are doing, one of the very few protections workers actually have in this country.
Yeah, and it's very scary. I mean, I can't tell you that I wasn't nervous today, because I absolutely was. And I absolutely am nervous to go back to work tomorrow, because I can just imagine what kind of punishment I'm going to get for what I did today. But ultimately, it was worth it for me, not only for Walmart associates, not only for myself, but Walmart seems to set the precedence for other companies across the United States, because they are the leader. And companies are saying, we don't have to give people raises because Walmart don't. We don't have to give people health care because Walmart doesn't, and they set the bar for that. So it's not just about us as Walmart workers. It's pretty much about all working-class America.
And which is why I think this is such an important story, and I think people need to hear more of it. You know, today during your event, your job action, can you tell me what happened?
Well, a group of about 20 associates from my store, which is huge because we only have about 100, all either walked off the job today or called in last night to strike for today. We joined together in front of my store, which is the smaller store in Federal Way, Washington. And we first went up to the store doors, where we weren't allowed to come in unless we had a work badge, even though we had community allies of probably about 150 people, organizations out there with us. None of them were allowed to go in either, although they were customers. And we basically joined together, you know, said a few things, and then we walked across the back of our parking lot and we met up. We had some speakers. I was one of them. And then we went back to the store and tried to go in. They wouldn't allow us.
Right. And hopefully you handed out some information so people who are going
absolutely
in.
Absolutely, we did.
Because at the end of this, it's going to take people like customers. I generally don't shop at Walmart, but some people do. It's going to take customers. It's going to be the people that you serve and the people that you take care of that are going to help you as well. Those are going to be your strongest allies, because the hope is that the business model changes so that it makes your experience better and mine as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not a disgruntled employee. I've never been in any trouble at Walmart. I've never been coached or reprimanded for anything. So a lot of people are saying, well, they're disgruntled employees. We're not. We're just people who want better. We want respect. We want to be able to speak our mind and not be punished for it. You know, we want to make a decent living. And we did pass out flyers to customers today, and pretty much the large majority of customers were on our side. They were honking for us. They were giving us high fives in the parking lot. And then that is the most important person to see us, because I don't think they really understand the hardships we go through.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I've spoken to a number of Walmart associates and workers in the chain, and I've yet to find a disgruntled one. Everyone that I talk to, you know, I love my job. I love the people I work with. I love the customers. I want to do the best possible job and make the company, you know, as successful as it can be. But I also want that respect. I also want to be able to feed my children. I also want to have some security in knowing what my hours are going to be, not just today, tomorrow, but down the road as well. Things that I think all working class people deserve in this country.
Absolutely. And I feel like people look down on me because I do receive forms of public assistance, but I try. Like, if there was a better job out here right now, I would find a better job, but I can't get a better job right now because the economy is so messed up. And I do love my job. I work very hard. I mean, I definitely help the upper management make their money. I'm the person who's there talking to the customers and handling all the problems. And it's just really not right.
And going forward from this point, this day of action forward to Black Friday, what do you expect? I mean, tomorrow when you back, I assume you're expecting some type of retaliation, some type of statement or something. But as you move towards Black Friday, because I understand there are thousands of actions being planned and in the works as we speak, to highlight exactly what we've been talking about.
Absolutely. You should expect to see something going on every single day until Black Friday and through Black Friday. And on Black Friday, we will all stand together again, except for nationwide this time. It won't be just a state-by-state basis. We will all be together. And we probably are going to get retaliated against. But the good thing is, we're not alone. We're together. And when you stand together with other people, you're stronger.
Absolutely.
And that's the importance. We're not alone.
It's that solidarity. And you've got a friend here at the Rick Smith Show. We stand in solidarity with you. And as this goes on, we'd love to have you back and have your story and tell us what's going on.
I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you guys listening to me and appreciating us, because it is a really scary thing to do.
Well, I mean, you're changing the world. I mean, you are changing the future of this country for my children and all the future working people, because the conditions that you set for today and tomorrow are what my kids are going to endure in the future. So I thank you for your bravery. I thank you for your time and keep up the fight.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Sarah Gilbert. Quick break, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
I'm gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
It's not easy to get in the face of power and defy the conventional wisdom. You can quickly get to feeling like B.B. King when he sings, "Nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving too." Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein know that lonely feeling. This pair of think tank political pundits has long been popular on Washington's insider talk show circuit as cautious middle-of-the-road voices of conventional thinking. But then, they went rogue. Recently, Mann and Ornstein charged that the elite media deliberately failed to cover the biggest 2012 election story of all, namely that the Republican Party and its nominees were flagrantly running a campaign of lies. The duo was surprisingly blunt, noting that the GOP was not just practicing politics as usual with a fib here and a prevarication there, but an orchestrated strategy of dumping bald-faced fabrications wholesale on the voting public. "It's the great, unreported, big story of American politics," said Ornstein. While the Democrats, too, tossed out some falsehoods, there was no comparison between them and the Republicans' ideologically extreme perversion of, quote, "facts, evidence, and science." Yet reporters and their bosses, fearful of being accused of taking sides, failed to make a distinction, which, after all, is their job. "They're so timid," Mann said, "and a timid press is a weak one." "You're failing in your fundamental responsibility," Ornstein said of them, asking the obvious question, "What are you there for? Your job is to report the truth." This is Jim Hightower saying, as their reward for daring to tell the truth about the media's abject failure, Mann and Ornstein have been blackballed. They're no longer invited to talk on the insider shows, nor have those shows even mentioned the media's pusillanimous role in abetting the big lies of 2012.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Let my daddy come on, knew how it works when he came home from World War II. How the yards just scrapped and rubber. He says them big boys did whatever could have been. Yeah, these mills, they built the tanks and bombs that won this country war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were to die for. There's no comes time. Here he comes time.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I listened to that story, and I'm sincere when I say, look, you know, I think that these folks who work for Walmart, they work for these supply chains, these are brave folks. Just like those kids, those J-1 students who came here from countries around the globe to work at a packing plant that they paid for the privilege to work at, I think that they're brave and willing to stand together and stand up to fight for better conditions, not for themselves, but for the community, for others. That to me is what grabs me and is so powerful. That these people, yeah, they want to make their conditions better. But they're changing the world. They're changing the future. And, you know, the reason I keep bringing the story up of my grandmother's generation, because, you know, you go back to that time, and as she said, look, here we are 27 years later, and the wage that they make isn't but a buck in the same dollars, not in inflated dollars, in actual dollars, only a buck difference in 27 years. You know, you go back then, the minimum wage back in the early mid-80s was $3.35. So, I mean, stop and think about it. And this is what I've been saying. We should have a minimum wage that emulates, like, Australia. Their minimum wage is somewhere around 17, like 16-something, almost 17 bucks an hour. And I get the argument, well, you know, we wouldn't be able to hire anybody, but you factor that in. And the reality is you need to have policy as a nation that says there's a bottom line. Where if you're the most powerful corporation in the world, you're this mega global conglomerate, and you're saying I can't pay but crummy wages where the workers have to go and ask for health care from the state government, funded by taxpayers, the most powerful company on the globe? You don't think there's something wrong with that? You get someone like this John Schnatter or whatever his name is, the guy who owns Papa John's, the CEO there, saying, well, you know, we're going to cut people's hours because, you know, that couple million dollars, that's going to destroy our empire. A guy who lives in this palatial, I mean, the pictures, you should Google it. I mean, it's what an amazing property this guy lives on, and it's fantastic. I mean, it is a pure, I mean, it's the craftsmanship, the hands that built that, you know, those people are absolutely proud of what it is that they accomplished, even though they'll probably never be allowed to walk in the door. But what they built, what they constructed is just amazing and marvelous. And I don't begrudge him. I mean, Mitt Romney says, well, you know, the Democrats, they don't want anybody to live like this. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I don't want a situation where he's living like that, where we've got people living in poverty, doing the job, making him the money. There's a problem here. The idea is that we all do better together. And I look at, you know, Papa John has come into, again, I'm surprised it's taken this long because this is a statement he's made in the past about health care, that he's going to cut people's way, he's going to cut their hours. Because, and this is what grabs my attention, and understand what I've been saying for years. The Republicans do everything they can possibly do to poison pill things. They put things in, you know, I have a friend who lost her job and, you know, did not qualify right away for food stamps, did not qualify for a lot of the programs that are out there. And quickly she was able to find another job, had very good skills, and didn't need them. But now she's one of these people who said, well, those, they shouldn't exist because they weren't there when I wanted them. And I said, well, you do know why some of these things are in place, right? Because you've got politicians who ideologically are opposed to them. And they want to make the obstacle so high. They want to make the obstruction so great. They want to make the path to getting them so onerous that you give up and you stop. So I look at Obamacare. I look at the Affordable Care Act, and you go, okay, there's a provision in there that says, you know what, if you've got 50 or more employees and you work them more than 30 hours, you have to provide them with health care. And you go, well, where did that come from? And as I argued about Obamacare from the beginning, this really was Romney care. Most of it was very conservative ideas from the 90s. A lot of this stuff came out of the Hillary care fund when the conservatives said, no, this is what we want instead, which is what morphed into Romney care and then Obamacare. Olympia Snow, the Republican from Maine, it was her brainchild. Maybe not her brainchild, but she's the one who put it in. She's the one who demanded it. She was the champion of this. People with 50 or more employees have to pay a penalty. Because the thought was, is if you're already providing health care coverage for your employees, they don't want you dumping those employees and putting them on the backs of the taxpayers. So they said, if you got 50 or more, you got to provide it or you're going to be fined. That's where it came from. So as I've been saying, you've got the Republicans who poison pill things because they want obstacles. They want to make it difficult. They want to put hurdles in the way. So I read this piece by GOP USA, one of these right-wing blog sites, you know, just your basic shill group. But they're talking about this guy, John Metz, who owns a number of Florida restaurants, owns a bunch of Denny's and some wings place that they talk about. And he's got a number of them. I think it was like 14 or maybe it was 40. I think it was 40. He owns 40 Denny's restaurants franchises and I guess some wing place. He's saying that, and this is what the article says. It says Florida restaurant owner John Metz says he will offset the cost of Obamacare by adding a 5% surcharge to customers' bill and will reduce his employees' hours. So when I'm reading this, I'm going, well, if he's going to add a 5% surcharge to the bill, aren't I the customer paying it? So why are you reducing the hours? So what you're saying then is you're going to use Obamacare as an excuse to steal not only from the customer, but also from the employee. Sounds like a good business model for me. Sounds like a very conservative thing to do. The article goes on to say Obamacare requires businesses or franchises with 50 or more workers to offer an approved insurance plan or pay a penalty of $2,000 for each full-time worker who works over 30 hours. It then goes on to quote Metz saying, to pay $5,000 per employee would cost $175,000 per restaurant. And he says, we don't do it. We don't make it. So we've got to make this up by putting this 5% surcharge. So my first question is the penalty's $2,000. He's charging $5,000. Wow. Seems to me to be a ripoff. Then I go back to my original thought of Obamacare from the beginning. Why are we depending on employers to provide health care? Why do we have this mentality that controls us into this world that we have to have employment-based care? And this is where it takes me back to my theories on single payer. Why do I want Papa John's or John Metz or the people who, or what is it, Darden Corporation who owns Olive Garden and Red Lobster and all those other places? Why do I want them involved? Because we know they're going to game and cheat the system. This 30-hour thing was put in there so that they would cheat the system and they would make it impossible for people to get. This is the poison pill. And the more we learn about Obamacare and more we learn about the poison pills, because you remember the argument? Obama didn't ask for any Republican input. They rammed it down our throats. Remember that? Yet you learn that this obstacle put in by a Republican, you know, the ones that nobody listened to, the poison pill. And I look at this and I go, you know, the thing that gets me is that we have this belief And I don't understand why the big three automakers didn't years ago fight to get health care off their back. I don't know why these big corporations didn't say, we don't want to do it, other than control. To me, and I've said this before, I mean, this is a very simple concept. To me, healthcare should be something that follows you cradle to grave. And I've said before, I don't care if it's public single payer or a privately run system like Sweden has that's mandated cradle to grave. That your rates aren't going to go through the roof if you get sick, that it's going to be set by the state, and this is what it's, the charge is going to be, and it's going to follow you the day till you die with a goal of making you well, not fixing you when you're broken. I mean, we have really screwed up priorities in this country to where, and this, I guess, is the problem. There's so much money in the healthcare system, so much investor class money tied up, so many people who have bought hospitals because, hey, we can make money because we know people are going to get sick. That the incentive is not to keep people well, but to be reactive, not be proactive, not do the things that we know. Regular checkups, you know, regular interventions, regular treatments that are going to be, you know, preventative. We're going to wait till the cancers come. And understand, if we took public ownership of healthcare, a lot of the cancers that we get might even actually be looked at because of the pollution and because of a lot of the emissions and a lot of the things that we allow corporations to externalize those costs. You know, the 50 to 60,000 people a year who die from occupational illness, maybe we would look at that a little differently. Or maybe not. Because, again, the people who hold the profits, they don't want to give up on this system because there's too much money in it. And now this Affordable Care Act has kind of changed the game. And look, as an employer, you know, I'm looking at this system going, it's going to be a little more paperwork for me to figure out how to weave through this system. And, you know, PR, or public relations, the HR people, the human resource people are pulling their hair out trying to figure out how to comply with the paperwork. Which is why you're going to hear more businesses whining about this. Like the guy who owns these franchises. Saying that, you know, the average check at his restaurant is $9 and he's going to add a surcharge of 45 cents. So let me ask you. As a consumer, would you be upset if a restaurant put a 45-cent surcharge on there, knowing that the person who's serving you, the person who's cooking your food, the person who's taking care of you, their family is secure? Would you go to a place that did that? Because I would. And the hope is that the more these employers do this, and you're going to see more. Understand, this is the beginning of it. Because they feel empowered. They feel like they've got some control and that we're going to show you who the boss is. The hope is the more they do this, the more we wake up and go, wait a minute. Stop screwing with our family's future. Stop screwing with our security. And maybe then we will move away from this employer-based system. Because there's got to be a realignment in the labor relations world. And as soon as we have the ability to say, you know what, I'm not taking this. My healthcare benefits are portable. I can move those. And I would love to see a public pension option as well. My pension is portable. Kind of like the building trades model. If you work construction, you have a centralized healthcare and a centralized pension system. It doesn't matter what employer you work for. You can work for 40 employers. You're paying into a centralized system so that you know that it's being taken care of. To me, that seems like the right model. And the employers can come and go. Because as we're seeing, you know, you look at the Romney model of turning companies around, the first thing they do is they wipe out all those workers' pensions. Get rid of all that obligation. It's good business. I'm telling you, I'm hoping that the more we see the more of these John Shatners and the more of these John Metz and the more of the Olive Garden people who keep coming out saying, well, we're just going to cut our workers' hours. The more I'm hoping you're going to see workers saying, screw you, you're cutting my hours. We're going to join and form unions, and we're going to collectively bargain, and we're going to get some of the profits. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but Darden, the people who own Olive Garden and a whole bunch of other, they're wildly profitable. As is, if you look at the mansion that Papa John lives in, so is Papa John's. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game? From the master of the cloak and dagger.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Is that old washer?
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
Scientists who worked with fossils found in Tanzania have discovered what might be the oldest known dinosaur by at least 10 million years.
In other words, this dinosaur lineage appears 10 million to 15 million years earlier in the fossil record than any other known dinosaur. It's from the Middle Triassic period, which spanned a time between about 247 million and about 235 million years ago.
The researchers didn't have much to work with, just one humerus or upper arm bone and six vertebrae. They determined that the animal likely stood upright and measured 7 to 10 feet in length, about 2 to 3 meters, including its long tail.
When this dinosaur lived, the world's continents were joined together in a landmass called Pangaea. What's now Tanzania would have been part of southern Pangaea, sometimes called Gondwana or Gondwanaland, a supercontinent that also included Africa, South America, Antarctica, and Australia. These researchers said the new findings placed the early evolution of dinosaurs and dinosaur-like reptiles in the southern part of Earth's globe.
They said this specimen has a lot of history. The bones were discovered in the 1930s and first described in the 1950s. Now, 80 years later, modern scientists have put the pieces together enough to publish their work. They did this in the journal Biology Letters in December of 2012.
Today's program was made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
You know, when I hear the CEO there, Rex Tillerson, the guy from ExxonMobil, go, you know, hey, we're going to adapt because we've adapted. You know, I'm thinking about my crazy religious friends who don't believe in evolution. And that just popped into my head because what he's basically saying is we will evolve. We'll figure out how to breathe, you know, oil, air. We'll figure out how to live off of drinking oil. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the other part of me goes, well, you know, who cares? We screw up the world. We'll evolve. We'll figure it out. Either that or we'll just live in a bubble. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Let's go to Washington, D.C. for our correspondent, Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's great to be here. You know, it looks like they may advocate for, breathing poison air and drinking oil water, but, you know, if they're going to do that, it looks like there may be some legal ramifications. You know, one of the big news coming out of Washington today was that BP agreed to a $4.5 billion settlement.
$4.5 billion with a B. The question that I had when I saw that is, how much did it actually cost the people who were affected by it?
I don't have that exact number, but the remaining of it, there's still going to be a good chunk that's going to go towards civil suits. There is about, the way it's divided up, there's going to be $1.26 billion in criminal fines, $2.4 billion in U.S. Fish and Wildlife Foundation donations, as well as about $350 million to the National Academy of Sciences and $525 million to the Securities Exchange Commission over the next 3 years. It also looks like two of the employees may be facing manslaughter charges. That has not come up yet, but that's still on the table. BP has noted that the remainder of that is going to go towards the civic fines that they're facing, including the damage that they paid to the Gulf Coast. This is not going to include that. This is just solely what's going to the government.
So any Republicans on the Hill, like when they had to put up the $25 billion to fix the mess that they created, anybody saying it's a shakedown? Anybody out there going apologizing for the fine? I remember Congressman Joe Barton, if I remember correctly, he was the one who apologized to the CEO saying, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry we're shaking you down for you destroying our environment. Sorry so much.
Exactly. You know, that was a lesson that they learned, hopefully not to do that again. And so far we've seen a pretty measured response. Nobody's saying that they should not be paying for the damage that's done. In fact, we saw one conservative congressman, Rep. Scalise, come out today and say that this was a good-sized fine and that this would, cover the damage adequately. The news is still pretty young, and we could see some people, maybe even those in the Energy Committee like last time around, coming out and saying something that's going to leave them with their foot in their mouths.
So the people that are potentially going to be on the hook to spend time as a guest of the state in the Gray Bar Hotel, how high up the food chain do they go? I mean, these are people who are going to go, you just fall on the sword for the big guy and we'll take care of you.
I believe the three that are facing, manslaughter charges are executives in the evening. I'm not sure how far up they go, but it's still on the table and it's still a pretty big threat. And it's still going to send a message to a lot of the corporations out there, who may think about skimping on safety.
No, I mean that's a step in the right direction, I guess. I personally would like to see more, being a guest of the state. But I guess too, that's better than none. You're right; it may actually send a message. Talk about the big thing. Did you know that this whole Petraeus thing, Obama set this up? It's a conspiracy. Did you know that Obama did this because he knew that the Benghazi thing was going to happen. He needed a fall guy. Did you know that?
Absolutely. You know, it was so so convenient of him just to send in one of his secret agents, Broadwell into this. But no, that is the stuff that we're hearing from the insane conspiracy blogs. It doesn't seem like many people really take it seriously. There are some people questioning the timing, namely that it came after the election. But nobody is, nobody is taking seriously is really advocating a lot of these conspiracy theories, although there is a lot of people on the right who have some considerable influences to make him up. He today told Headline News off-camera in an interview that this was not about Benghazi. If he could go on record now, there's not really much more he can lose. He's already had his name tarnished.
Right.
So hopefully that'll put a lot of the conspiracy theories to rest. And tomorrow he's going to be appearing on the Hill in a closed-door session at 9 a.m. to testify before the House Intelligence Committee. So there may be more news coming out of that tomorrow. And, he has pretty much been on the same page with the administration from day one over the actual timeline of Benghazi. There was a testimony where he did say that it was initially believed that it was a response to that video and that it was not necessarily, as a lot of right-wing people are saying, a catastrophic administration failure. And I believe he's likely going to say that tomorrow since, doesn't really seem like he's in a position to try to score political points for a future 2016 run that now looks like it's never going to happen.
Yeah, so now that you've said all that, you know, I go back to the conspiracy theorists who keep telling me that, you know, the Obama knew and he's setting this guy up because he was going to, evidently in this conspiracy world that I've heard, Petraeus was going to be the whistleblower, and they had him under their thumb to keep him in line. And I'm going, well, if he's already, you know, he's already outed and he's saying, oh, you know, it's as it was, what's the conspiracy?
Exactly. He had nothing left to lose, and Petraeus was really this kind of a crass political figure that a lot of these blogs are sort of making him out to be. You know, you can guarantee that he would have come out before the election or resigned prior to that and really, blew the whistle on this if there wasn't anything to hide. You know, it seemed that if he did, kind of do a quid pro quo with the administration, he's not getting his end of the bargain, and he has nothing else really to stand up with. So I really just cast a lot of doubt on what really shouldn't be taken seriously in the first place.
Yeah, and I see that the Pentagon is going to do a review of the soap opera because evidently our military has, as the military turns the new latest daytime drama, I guess. Tell me a little bit about that.
Today Panetta announced that there was going to be a new review for the senior officers. This is really coming on the heels of not just Petraeus, but with John Allen being inserted in the scandal, as well as a, finding yesterday that demoted a 4-star general to a 3-star over misusing travel funds, paying military aircraft to shuttle his wife to shopping sites, as well as a Air Force investigation into Lackland, where it was found that some training officers actually engaged in some pretty serious sexual misconduct. So the timing is right for it. There's certainly an argument to say that this is no better time to do it. This is going to be spearheaded by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, and it's going to be done among the service chiefs. And, it may just be lip service at the end. We may not see better actions from, the senior officers, but at least it's them acknowledging that there is a problem.
Am I alone in this thought that I really don't care what people do in their sex lives? I don't care, Justin. If I don't know if you're married, but I don't care if you're cheating on your wife. That's between the two of you. I don't care what the general was doing with his little general. I do care if he was giving out secrets. I do care if our military was somehow compromised or national security was compromised. I care about that. But what consenting adults do within the confines of their four walls with each other, I think we should just get over already.
Yeah, that's a good point. It really seems that there was no, national security secrets divulged from Petraeus, if you believe him. He told in that same interview today that he did not give anything away. Also, Attorney General Eric Holder said that there was no national security secrets compromised, or else he would have told the White House and he would have told Congress beforehand when the investigation was going on. So it really is sort of a non-story, but there are still people who are raising eyebrows of this, and there's still some parts of this scandal that are not really being paid attention to now, but could likely come up, particularly why the FBI was, conducting this investigation, if the emails that prompted it weren't necessarily as threatening as we've heard from some people. And, at the very least, it may, bring on some questions about Internet surveillance and, a lot of the Patriot Act stuff that's going on today that a lot of progressives are quite angry about.
Yeah, me being one of them. I follow the theory. I've always followed the I'm not writing stuff down. I don't care what it is. I'm not texting it. I'm not emailing it. I don't believe in it.
Well, you seem to be better off for the 21st century than the CIA director.
Well, there you go. Absolutely. You look at this, and this whole thing with Benghazi is still on the front of the right wing's plate. In fact, John McCain out doing a whole bunch of media, doing a whole bunch of press, all kinds of stuff, actually missed the hearing into the Benghazi attack.
He did, and when he was questioned about it, he gave a pretty rude response to a reporter who's been kind of, more grumpy than usual these days. It's being taken on. No one can really say that this is not political grandstanding. A lot of the stuff to Rice is a lot of the opposition to Rice, which is connected to this, a lot of the calls for a special hearing are really just kind of ludicrous on its face. Rice, especially when you consider not just the fact that Condoleezza Rice was supported by Jane, as well as a number of other members of the administration, but also the fact that the quotes in question is really no cover up from Suzanne Rice. There did not appear to be a peer suggestion that she was just calling for calling the attacks a response to a YouTube video. It all seems to really check out at the end of the day when you look at this.
Yeah, I mean, but again, what it shows me is, he's out there screaming, "Oh, we need to have an investigation, we need to have a hearing, we need to probe," and they're doing it, and he's not there.
No, he is not. And that's, you know, just gives further evidence to the fact that this is really just kind of grandstanding.
Yeah. Last line of questioning I've got for you. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this cliff, I guess, or as I've been saying, it's the fiscal mirage coming up that, you know, again, I guess, you know, folks there in D.C. have created, have put right in front of our nose so that we pay attention to that. And of course, the little general's habits. Where are we going with this? I mean, at some point, liberals, Democrats, people are going to have to stand up and say, we're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. We're not going to harm the poor and make sure that the very wealthy in the country do so much better. Anything going on around that? I mean, any of the senators, any people standing up and saying no more?
Well, yesterday we saw the president saying that he was going to ensure that the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy did expire. We saw him meet with some progressive groups not too long ago. Congress, they are continuing to call for the president to lead, which is kind of a strange abdication of authority on this. You know, something has to be done soon, according to all the serious minds, even though this doesn't necessarily seem like it's going to be as cataclysmic as a lot of people are saying if it does drop off. But right now, it's just sort of moving in circles.
It's the cliff, didn't you know? It's Tax-mageddon.
Yep, that's some clever imagery to be sure.
It's the austerity bomb. I've heard that one. That's good. I've heard fiscal showdown. I've heard a whole bunch of things. It's the end. It's all over.
Yep.
It is all.
So we'll see what happens. But you know, the president has the political capital right now to hold firm on a lot of his positions. So that should be some comfort going into this.
Well, let's hope he does. Let's hope a spine came with that election on last Tuesday, and it gives him a little bit of a spine, or maybe Hillary will let him borrow her set.
Yep.
You never know. Justin Duckham, appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Hey, thank you.
Our good friend Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Louie Gohmert, one of my favorite crazies in Congress, Texas Republican, he has launched a campaign. Yes, the House leadership there, the Republican House leadership, electing a new speaker. Boehner's got nothing to worry about. But Louis Gohmert, he, he has nominated Newt Gingrich as the Speaker of the House. Yep. According to Gohmert, you don't have to be a member of the body to be Speaker. No one seconded his motion. And, you know, as I thought of that, why not go with Tom DeLay? Because I think DeLay was a much, much more powerful speaker. You know, the hammer actually did put the hammer down. I got an email from Helen who pointed out a tweet from George Takei saying marriage equality and marijuana laws passed. He said, now we know what Leviticus really meant by a man who layeth with a man must be stoned. And I wrote her back. I said, well, I don't think that they meant stoned as in high. I think they meant stoned as in rocks. But, you know, the right, maybe he was right. You know, maybe the right got it wrong. Because you look in Seattle where the police department there has, they've published a little pamphlet, a little informative PSA, if you will, called Marriage of What Now? A guide to legal marijuana use in Seattle, and answer some very simple questions like, you know, can I smoke pot outside my house? If I'm at the park, can I just light one up? And according to them, it's kind of like having an open container of alcohol. If you do it, you could get a civil infraction, you know, like a ticket or something. Not arrested, but, you know, just a little thing. They said, you know, whatever you do in the privacy of your own home, that's up to you. But, you know, in public, not so much. Additionally, they said if smoking a cigarette isn't allowed where you say inside an apartment, you know, building, you know, wherever, smoking marijuana isn't allowed either. One of my favorite questions addressed by the pamphlet is, will policemen be allowed to smoke marijuana? And what they say as of right now, no. So policemen not allowed. They're not real citizens, evidently. They say it's still a very complicated issue. They said if they apply for a job at the Seattle Police Department, will past or current marijuana use be held against them? And they say the current standard for applicants is that they have not used marijuana in the previous 3 years. But in light of, you know, this law, the department will consult with the city attorney and state attorney general to see, you know, how to revise that. But a lot of very good questions. You know, can I grow my own? You know, and according to the pamphlet, no, not right now. They say in the future under state law, you may be able to get a license to grow or sell marijuana. Yeah, yeah, we're licensing it. And maybe now you've got the drug gangs who, you know, maybe the cartels will get a license. Maybe they'll go legit. Kind of like, I don't know if you've seen the big TV show, Moonshiners. They keep talking about, you know, they're making illegal moonshine, talking about going legit. And I'm going, in this day and age, you're still making stuff out in the woods. Funny stuff. They say another one that I like is, can I legally carry around an ounce of marijuana? And according to the recently passed initiative, beginning December 6th, adults over 21 will be able to carry up to 1 ounce for personal use, no more than that. That's it. Please note, though, they say that the initiative says it is unlawful to open a package containing marijuana in view of the general public. So if you've got it, you better hide it. Interesting document, if you will. And I guess you have to. I guess you have to come out with this. And good for the Seattle Police Department for coming out with Marriage of What Now, a legal guide to the new law there. And I got to wonder, you know, what's going to happen on the federal level? Because it's still federally not legal. And as we see, I think there are going to be more states. You know, as George Takei said, marriage equality and marijuana, maybe that's what he meant. Brings a whole new image, if you will. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Questions, comments, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Love to hear them. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming.